consider proposals and recommendations from the committee. And the first committee is the process committee.
Madam Chair, members of the commission, the chair of the process committee is not able to join you today, so I will take care of the first three proposals from the committee and the recommendations on statewide elected lieutenant governor to serve as Senate president, number two, to reinstate term limits so that members serve no more than two terms, and the third issue of unicameral legislature. The committee recommended that we take no further action on any of those proposals. I would be happy to answer questions related to any of those proposals, and I'm sure any of the committee members would like to chime in about that.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt just one minute before we really get started with that, Marjorie. Do you want to talk about voting or quorum and where we are?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, according to the rules of this commission, we are required to have 16 affirmative votes for any motion to pass in the commission.
And I see, I think 17.
I think we have 18.
18. All right.
Madam Chair, just to refresh my memory as a parliamentary sense, if a proposal doesn't receive the required constitutional majority or statutory majority here, and if it is defeated for lack of that, although it comes close, is it dead or can it be revived under some parliamentary circumstance when there is a little bit more robust attendance?
Madam Chair and Commissioner Frommeyer, what I would suggest is that if we feel that something might not pass, perhaps we shouldn't vote on it today and reschedule it for a future meeting. If it fails, we could take it up at a future meeting as long as somebody who voted no serves a reconsideration, and we can continue from there, suspend the rules and do that.
All right. Three, discussion to the first proposal, number 55, statewide elected lieutenant governor to serve as Senate president. A comment or discussion?
Madam Chair, do you need a motion? I move the commission adopt the recommendation of the subcommittee.
Second.
Then moved and seconded. Is there any discussion to the motion? I'm going to do this wrong, so I'm using the process, so I know. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. All right, thank you. Proposal 107. Reinstate term limits so members serve no more than two terms. Discussion or motion?
Just discussion. Part of our early discussions, the first or second meeting, was the lack of experience of legislators when we had the long-term legislators leave. The fact that it takes two or three sessions at least to start building relationships with working with other legislators and to understand the process of really getting something done. And if you want to have a bipartisan legislature, they're working together to take the very best and the people and the will of the people who would maybe want that person to serve a third term. I don't think it would serve Oregon very well, and I don't think today, if you were to put term limits on the ballot, I'm not certain that it would pass. In fact, I don't think it would.
I move we accept the recommendation of the subcommittee.
Second.
Is there any more discussion to the motion?
Madam Chair, just a footnote, what was previously said by Representative Krieger. The effect of this long term is to shift power fairly dramatically to the executive branch and to the professional lobby. And while these are all good people, it really changes the structure of our government in a fundamental, non-representative way, in my view. So I will be joining with this motion.
All right, everyone understands this is to reinstate term limits.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Take no further action.
Sorry. Okay. I was freaking out for a minute.
You
good poker face there.
My hair almost turned red.
Hey.
That would have done it.
Are you happy, Connie? Be careful.
All right. All the favorite things I was saying, all right.
All
the same. At the peril of your life. Motion passed. Thank you. Okay. Proposal 20, unicameral legislature.
Madam Chair and members, again, the committee recommended that we take no further action on that recommendation.
Any discussion? Motion. Yes, David.
I would move that we accept, the commission accept the committee's recommendation. No further action.
Can someone from the committee say why they, kind of what was the substance of that recommendation, why they came to that recommendation?
Madam Chair and Commissioner Martin, the unicameral legislature was originally tied to nonpartisan. Nebraska is unicameral and nonpartisan. When we started the discussion about unicameral nonpartisan, it was heard in committee that the more interesting, more important piece was the nonpartisan aspect of the Nebraska process. So we declined to take further action on the unicameral piece.
Chair, as a member of the committee, I could add, we could talk about this at greater length. We did, in fact, discuss various models for a structure different from the present structure of the legislature. If you had more seats to spread around, smaller districts, that kind of thing. But that particular solution did not appeal to any of the members of the committee. Nothing else was proposed by the committee. I'm not suggesting that we have some other magic bullet. Some of us have had ideas about how it ought to be done. But we don't want to waste your time on something that the committee did not decide to do.
Mr. Frommeyer, thank you.
Madam Chair, I did miss the process committee's discussion of this, but I've been of the longstanding view that in the unicameral legislature, you lack what you get in a bicameral legislature, and that is that for some members of the public, the first notice they really have that a measure is being considered is when they get notice that it's passed one house of the legislature, and that gives them a chance to then bring their views to the other chamber, whereas with the unicameral legislature, I think there is the danger of this, if you will, the bill that sneaks up on everyone, and then all of a sudden it's law and on its way to the governor before the public's really had a full chance to debate it. So this is, in essence, the bicameral system is a backstop and maybe a healthy one.
Well, although I feel fairly certain that a bicameral legislature would never pass a unicameral measure itself, since we're making the recommendations to the legislature and not trying to pass a constitutional amendment, this isn't going to happen on our watch. But I would say it. Commissioner Lindy suggested to me when I was pontificating one day about how bad a unicameral legislature would be that I go read a law article that was written in Nebraska when they went to the unicameral legislature. I would suggest that you all get that article, if you haven't read it, and read it, because it really did open my eyes. I still would not ever personally support a unicameral system. However, the system that is described in that law article is much different than what I had envisioned the system to be. And it, if you talk about fair, open, a fair open system, it sure sounds like it is. The problems that I think some of us have with it is that although it's fair and open in its deliberation, it probably does drive some decisions back in further, deeper into the caucus rooms, which is something that the public in Oregon doesn't seem to want. So it's kind of a catch-22 almost, but it is a very interesting article. I would suggest if you haven't read it, you might educate yourself to how it's put together in Nebraska. Thank you. I'll be voting yes on the motion.
All right. Any more discussion to the motion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Thank you.
All right. Proposal 16, partisan versus nonpartisan legislation. Mr. Frommeyer, would you like to just lead this discussion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to lead it briefly, but I hope strongly, because I do hope that this passes the commission and is a recommendation of the legislature. And really, that's the first point I'll make, which is it is overtly only a recommendation, and it would require legislative action to implement it, and therefore further consideration in an even more wide-open set of forums, probably both houses. The point of this is to try to address in a way that is quite different than we have done in the past, and it's in keeping with the purpose of this commission, which is to propose things that wouldn't come up in the ordinary course of business, but which are eminently doable, and I think in the public interest. One of the major parts of our problem statement, which we more or less unanimously adopted as a commission, was that there was a perception on the part of the public, quite strongly held by members of both parties, that excessive partisanship, however defined, was inhibiting the legislative process, diminishing public confidence in the ability of that process to resolve issues in the public interest. So the purpose of this proposal is to bring before the commission and then ultimately the legislature the possibility that by law change, at least one chamber of the Oregon legislature be nonpartisan. I think that would be met with overwhelming public approval. Staff shared with me a recent result of last week's election, which was Tillamook County, in which the voters by nearly 4-1 approved a measure to change the county commission from partisan to nonpartisan election. I will share with this commission that only 2 weeks ago, in a chance I had to speak before the foundations and citizens represented by the Oregon Community Foundation, in an audience of more than 1,000 people in the city, but representing the entire state, I spoke to various proposals that were pending not only before this commission, but before the public. And the single one that received the largest and most spontaneous reaction from that very informed and interested crowd was the notion that one house of the legislature at least be nonpartisan. So I believe that this would be greeted as something of a head-turning recommendation, something that would show that we're not simply tinkering with minor procedural reforms at the outside and submitting just another report, but that in fact we're prepared to ask the legislature to undertake serious debate about a bolder issue concerning a serious problem, which is that of the perceived partisan edginess that may take away from our capacity as a legislative process to deal with the public interest. So that's the spirit in which the process committee brings this proposal before you, with the sincere hope that it receives the 16 votes required to advance it for further consideration by the legislature.
Any more discussion?
If anybody is interested more in the details of how this would be carried out, I hope you'll ask questions. I'm not going to be labeling it. The principle is what Commissioner Frommeyer said it is. Wouldn't compel either house to be nonpartisan, but it would make it possible for either house to be nonpartisan. That just takes a simple statutory change. It's easy to do. We have a couple of senators, as you know, Ringo was successful in putting through the Senate last session plan for a nonpartisan Senate. Senator Morse came to our meetings faithfully and talked about how difficult it was to get compromises across party lines when it was such a winner-take-all attitude toward organizing. And so we heard a lot, and we heard nothing contrary. If anybody has any doubts about it, I hope they'll raise them, because we've heard nothing contrary to this recommendation.
Thank you, Marla.
I'm going to vote for this, but I have the same problem with this that I had with the proposal for the session length last time, and that's that I don't think that this legislature and perhaps future legislatures would vote to do this, even though I guess the Senate did last time. I think it ought to be, if you're going to do this, it ought to be constitutional, and I think we should be, as a commission, we should be making proposals that really have some edge to them, quite frankly, to get people to pay attention. And I don't think we're doing that. So I would rather have this be a proposal for a constitutional amendment, but I'll vote for it.
Thank you. Any more discussion?
Madam Chair, I have some concerns that would help me if anyone on the committee could tell me whether you discussed it. I have some concerns that we would make recommendations for things that may look as if they will solve problems and, in fact, might not do it. It sounds good to talk about electing people on a nonpartisan basis, but I suspect that what you'd wind up with is maybe caucuses in the legislature, for example, that would intensify a bigger urban and rural split. I mean, you might have an urban caucus and a rural caucus because there tend to be. I guess I see when you're in the legislature, you have a need for some mechanisms for organizing how you're going to manage the legislature, and I'm not quite sure around what kind of a structure one would manage the legislative session. I mean, you'd have a leadership group and all of that, but I guess that's one of my concerns. And then I share John Latimer's concern that it's a major policy change, and I'm not sure that I'm comfortable that we just leave it to, with apologies to the legislators, to the whims of the legislators, to do it, because it is a big policy change, and it seems to me that the people might need to be more directly involved in making the policy change. So was there any discussion in the committee about those issues? Help me out. I don't know how I'm going to vote on this.
It's interesting because I hear people say that if you think historically, think from the beginning, 1859 all the way till today, no party is ever mentioned in the Constitution. No partisan election is ever mentioned in the Constitution. There's always been a legislative choice to have partisan organization or to have partisan elections. They've done it all along. Putting in the Constitution would be an innovation, and there's no particular need for it because, while I appreciate John Latimer's recognizing that we ought to do something that looks important, actually it's important, but it doesn't have to be locked in there. That, too, would have to go through the legislature unless you're proposing that this commission address the public in favor of changing the initiative, changing the Constitution by initiative, which is a tough task. I mean, I've tried it once in 1964, so the Supreme Court wouldn't let us. The truth is that from the beginning of this country, there have been caucuses, they didn't always call themselves partisan caucuses, in a Congress or a state legislature that was elected on a nonpartisan basis. So yes, of course, people were organized around common interests. If you want to know how this works in the nonpartisan Nebraska legislature, that's what our co-chairman, Gary Wilhelm, said. That's what that article is mainly about. And it's very interesting. But obviously, neither House could vote to say, let's get elected on a nonpartisan basis in the next election, if they hadn't thought through the question of how they would organize themselves. Look, the picture everybody in the public correctly gets these days, and the testimony before us demonstrates, is that there are two teams fighting like mad to become the winner in a contest over control of each house. As the fundraising is directed at that, as the recruiting is directed at that, getting that majority is the ball game, after which the organization then turns over all the power basically to the majority leader or speaker, whatever the title is.
Well, you know, that's what we are trying to find a way out of. And the beauty of this solution, which is not radical, is that it makes it possible for those legislators who are otherwise inclined to form a majority across party lines as an alternative and say, look, guys, if you don't want to do business across party lines, we have enough votes to turn this whole body into a nonpartisan body and organize it on that basis, and then we would have interest groups, of course. But they wouldn't always be the same set of legislators who are locked into a specific position and role of followers just on the strength of the B or R behind their name when they ran for office, or whatever their particular district prefers, traditionally, historically, whatever, between R's and D's. Instead of being locked into that position, they'd have an option. And that's what all this does, is to say, if either house wants to go nonpartisan, the statute ought to make it possible for it to do that. It's a very simple and uncomplicated opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Ely.
I am very conflicted on this issue. And this is something, as I think Commissioner Lundy referenced, one that I've personally been involved with since the session, because the Senate did pass a nonpartisan resolution. So I have had the privilege, if you will, of observing many conversations about this topic. And I think what I struggle with is, what exactly is the problem we're trying to solve? The tone and tenor of elections, you just got to look to Multnomah County and the city of Portland. It doesn't help them a whole lot. Not to be disrespectful, but it's true. I think, speaking to what Mr. Lindy just commented on, the kind of winner-take-all 16 and 31, if you're struggling with that, then I think let's look at proposals that deal with the 16 and 31. There's nothing that would keep, and it has happened in recent history, a coalition of folks to put a leader into that position. Mm-hmm. But until you change the 16 and 31, you're always going to have that. I guess I would want to hear Gary, Commissioner Wilhelms, just reference something from an article, which I haven't had the chance to read, about the caucuses and being, you thought there was more ties to leadership, or it drove decisions into the caucus, and I would question, was that do you think that was driven by the unicameral nature of the body or the nonpartisan nature of the body? I would be interested to hear more about that. And I'm completely open to being convinced. I just haven't clearly heard the question we're trying to solve, I guess. Is that your spot?
Well, I think it's an opinion of mine that it drives it deeper into the caucus, but I think I could defend that, because if you're in an environment where there are not parties and there is only one house, it seems to me that whoever the elected leadership is going to be as certain as they can when they bring it to the body that the heavy lifting is done and it's clean, like we just did with the special session here. There was an agreement ahead of time. Now, I have to assume that some of those decisions were made in the respective caucuses. And I have to believe that in our own state that it wasn't easy it wasn't as easy for both caucuses on those four issues that we had before that special session. And I think that the decisions were probably, it's opinion again, I say, but it's my experience and opinion is that those decisions were probably made in caucus, and it wasn't a lot of fun in talking about them, but when it came to the public, it looked clean. You got it done, the legislature looked good. And I think that probably in Nebraska, that's kind of what's going on. A lot of the decisions are being made in the back rooms and are brought forward and then are anointed. We even when we made our field trip to the state of Washington, they're certainly not unicameral or nonpartisan, but they do have some processes and procedures that they utilize that are far different than Oregon. As an example, one bill for the entire budget. Well, nobody will ever convince me that there isn't some heavy-duty discussion going on in the caucuses before that bill is ever put together and brought. So that's kind of where I'm coming from, you know. But having said all of that in response to your question, I don't know why we can't do what it is we want to do in a partisan atmosphere. My experience in the legislature years ago was just that, things didn't pass because they were D or because they were R. There were usually on the big issues crossover votes. Maybe it was lopsided one way or the other, but there were a few votes that were brought across to give the majority, the 31 and the 16, if you will, that was necessary. And that was done in a partisan atmosphere when partisanship, in my opinion, was just as heavy as it is today, but was handled differently. You know, the typical comment is that you fight like hell during the day on the floor, but after that was over, that issue was over, and you moved on to the next issue, and it was a different fight tomorrow with a different coalition of people working on it. And so, and it wasn't 24/7 partisan bickering, which is kind of the appearance that we have sometimes today. So I believe that we could accomplish what it is we want to accomplish in a bipartisan, two-party atmosphere. Because I'm just having trouble convincing myself that going to a nonpartisan process would be necessary.
Mr. Harry, and then Hans, and then Barbara.
That latest commentary makes a lot of sense to me. It seems to me that if the legislature or either house wanted to operate in a nonpartisan way, it could do so now. And this proposal, as I read it, doesn't really compel it to do anything that it doesn't want to do. It really sounds more like window dressing, frankly. If we wanted to impose some kind of a nonpartisan approach in the legislature, we'd probably have to constitutionally ban parties, and that obviously can't be done. So it seems to me that this sounds important, but it really isn't all that important. The kind of atmosphere that our co-chairman has described is what we're after, but I don't think you can get it by making what seem a little somewhat limp recommendations. Thanks.
Ms. Carmel.
I think part of the discussion is about organizing principles. At the moment, it strikes me as an outsider that the primary organizing principle of the legislature is party. And part of what's behind this our committee's recommendation on nonpartisanship is to encourage the development of nonpartisan elections in order, a nonpartisan status, in order to find a new organizing principle, hopefully an organizing principle that is called the skill and ability of the leadership of the houses and the committees. And so I think the pursuit of a new organizing principle that is not party-based but is based upon talent, skill, ability, understanding of the process, ability to be effective in the leadership and in the activities of the legislature lie behind my support for this motion.
Mr. Merton.
It seems like we've got a moving target here, because a lot of what we're dealing with now is the, from what I understand, the consequence of the term limits. And what I would like someone to speak to who's had experience with the legislature is what do you see the impact of the cessation of term limits to the effect of partisanship? So we talk about people being here for more terms, understanding the process better, creating relationships with people across the aisle. Do we anticipate partisanship diminishing because of the change in term limits? And what impact does that have on this question?
I'd be happy to take a cut at that if it would be helpful. I mean, seen this legislature in a series of alliterations and kind of styles. Number one, I think they're unrelated. That's my personal take. I don't think whatever partisanship we have today, the level of it, the intensity of it, has anything to do with term limits. I think they're separate issues. I do want to, if I may, Madam Chair, just make one comment off of something that Commissioner Seeley said, and just so that everybody understands the context of how one of these bodies can organize themselves. There was a period of, and don't hold me to the exact length, but I'd say roughly 10 or 12 years, in which the Senate was run by a coalition of Republicans and conservative Democrats. And if you look in your blue book and you see that Debs Potts was president of the Senate or during that era, it was all basically a majority of the votes were Republican and a few votes were conservative Democrats. So they organized around philosophy and the interests of their districts without regard to partisan label. Now, I don't know how that speaks necessarily to the proposal that's been brought to us by the committee in a pretty strong manner, but I think it's important for people to understand that there are ways today that it can be done. It hasn't been done since that period, but the legislature does find a way to organize itself, and the classic example was the Senate three sessions ago when it was 15-15. And I thought they did a masterful job of figuring out how to function as an organization with an absolutely split partisan vote. And it was probably one of the smoother operating legislative bodies, maybe in some ways in recent times, and certainly from respecting the point of view of both the majority. Well, there wasn't a majority and a minority, but respecting the views of all the members. So I share former Senator Cease's kind of feeling. I'm not even sure how I'm going to vote on this today, that's why I'm glad we're having this discussion, because I'm not sure that this brings all I want.
This is a very good discussion, and Commissioner Merton's question. I have a couple of legislators that I would like to speak. Representative Krieger.
Madam Chair, I think last session when, you know, I brought this up before, when Jenny Burdick and I found out we could work together, you know, we were called, as I said before, the odd couple, fire and ice, and NRA was scared to death because it was fraternizing with her. But we got it done. That was the thing. 35 bills into two, we worked in a bipartisan manner, and we brought in a Democrat in my side, Reverend McPherson, and she brought in a senator from Republican that was minority. I'm doing the same thing right now. Kate Brown will be meeting with us tomorrow for the first time on the DHS review. Some things we're working on. The sexual predator work group we've got going, equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans coming together, working together. I think it's already started. I think a session or two ago it was so nasty that people had enough of it, and we're looking for ways of getting ourselves out of that. And those people who want to be totally partisan, I think are going to find themselves on the outside looking in. We're going to be working in that direction now. And we've already got these different work groups, 8 or 10 Republicans and Democrats, minority, majority party, working to make things happen on each of these issues. And I think we're well on our way. I don't think I could support the issue as it's now before us. I don't think we have defined what our real problem is. We have some scholars here. If you go back and look at the Federalists and Anti-Federalists and those people, who was it? Was it Madison, Hamilton, and Jay?
Hamilton.
Yeah. And the difficulty that they had in the fighting back and forth. But when it all got done, what did we end up with? Ended up with 10 more amendments, the Bill of Rights. Without them, we'd all be dead in water. So far as I'm concerned, I mean, I'm not a scholar, but I think in a long haul, our process is sometimes difficult, and that I think that makes us work harder and do a better job.
Representative Moon.
I have to agree with Representative Krieger on this, and one thing that hasn't been brought up here today is we're elected by our constituents, and they are either registered Democrat or Republican or independent or other parties, and I think that it should be their decision if we moved in this direction, because for us, I would think that, I mean, this is my opinion too, everybody's just saying their own opinion here. I would think, and speaking as well as I know my constituents, they would think that that's quite arrogant of this group to do and put on the, not this group, but to put it on the legislature and let them decide. They would rather, I would imagine, be the ones to decide. So, and I just think that they elect us according to who we are, our values, if they match their values closely. And if ours don't, we probably don't get elected. And if we come across as being argumentative or arrogant, we wouldn't get elected, because they want to be represented the best way possible here. And in their minds, if they're thinking, get over the party, you know, take your party hat off once you walk in the building, you know, it's over with. Parties are for elections process, but being, you know, congenial and working together in a short period of time is the best way to be in this building. And I think they expect that of us. And if we don't do it, they'll elect somebody else.
Commissioner Wilson. And then. Thank you.
No.
Mr.
Ferwire? Yeah. I suppose several points. First of all, this is entirely permissive. I don't, with all due respect to Representative Boone, I don't think this is arrogant. The Senate considered this proposal seriously last time they initiated it. This is simply a proposal that would say that's a good thing to keep discussing in either of the chambers, and if those chambers wish to proceed with it, they may do so. We're asking them to do something that's permissive. We're certainly not mandating anything in this commission. The second thing that I'd like to point out is that in very recent history, we had something in this building called the Rule of 18, which meant that if you didn't have 18 votes inside a secret caucus, a bill wouldn't see the light of day in the entire chamber. That's a pretty brutal stuff in terms of representative theory and practice. There's nothing academic about this. That's power politics. That's raw. And that was a consequence of a fairly extreme form of partisanship that can happen and has happened in either house as long as election by party label is the criterion. The third point is that, with all due respect again, if your party happens to be a minority party, your constituents are disenfranchised in a system of strong partisanship, because you'll get nothing but crumbs from the Queen's or the King's table. If any member of your party holds a gavel as chair or vice chair, it'll be an accident. And is that the way we want the whole state to be represented, especially underrepresented parts of it? Is it so strange in our theory that almost every county commission, almost every school board, almost every city council is elected on a nonpartisan basis? This is not a foreign, alien idea. It's something that we do to try to mute conflict in the cases where we see conflict as being contrary to our premises. And finally, just the great big elephant, whatever it is in the middle of the room, is money. It's campaign finance. And that when we have a system that puts so much on who gets to control the final distribution of seats on committees, membership of committees, then that becomes the place where campaign funds are aggregated and passed through. It makes elections enormously expensive. It increases the power of money over the process. And one of the reasons to have a nonpartisan chamber is to experiment to see whether the cost of elections and the price of access to power through money can be reduced. I think that it can. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Senate debated it so seriously last time, in addition to muting the concern about our publics. This process is way too edgy in terms of its partisan coloration and way too less concerned about ultimate outcomes on big issues that we haven't resolved yet.
Mr. Burns.
I don't know that this is necessarily a silver bullet, but when I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, and each policy that we look at, I kind of see it as, you know, what is our outcome? And I think in this circumstance, our outcome is to evaluate partisanship separate from all other things within the legislature and determine whether or not it serves the public as the public commission. And I think that although we have exceptional senators and representatives that overcome partisanship, by having to state that it's overcame, we're admitting it's a barrier to quality legislation, a barrier to citizens getting a deep, rich democracy, which I think that they want. I don't think that it adds to better elections that that folks are happy with. And so I think that we just have to, and the other elephant in the room is just partisanship hasn't necessarily served in the past in a way that we want. It can be overcame, but I don't know that necessarily we, as this entity that has the opportunity to represent the public in a unique capacity, should, you know, accept things that can be overcame. I think that we should send a message that it's really not that helpful. And I think that we've had decades of partisanship, and it's time for us to perhaps adopt something different to see if there is a way for us to get to a better quality of democracy. And so I think it's a good idea.
Mr. Sees.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think another thing that we need to remember, and I don't think I can support this proposal. In this country right now, we're caught in a time where those of us who are in the middle, and I do consider myself in the middle, despite the fact that I represented a district that 67% of it used to call itself very, very liberal. But I think we're caught between the bombs that the true believers on both ends of the spectrum are sort of lobbing over us. And I don't know that that has to do with partisanship in parties as much as it has to do with political philosophies. And I can remember being sort of frozen out by my caucus a couple of times because I wasn't going to go along with the true believers over on that end. And it was uncomfortable, but it was something that was not a Democrat or Republican thing, because we were, at that time, we were doing things with respectful relationships among legislators. And I'm worried that we're going to do things and or to recommend things that may actually not be solutions to the problem. I think the thing that's a real solution to the problem is not the partisanship or the nonpartisanship, but the respectful relationship that Representative Krieger was talking about. Thank you.
Commissioner Gordley.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Commissioner Burns spoke very eloquently what was in my head, but I would just like to add to that the summary of the committee discussion, just saying again what the opportunity is, and it's printed here on the report that the staff has prepared for us. The opportunity is this: one or both houses could opt to be nonpartisan. However, it would take a bill passed by both chambers and the governor to modify the definitions of nonpartisan office and related elections laws. Only a bill is required, but the legislature could try to put the nonpartisan house into the Constitution with the help of voters. That's the opportunity that we're discussing, and it's an opportunity that I support. I believe that we have the opportunity to push the envelope as far as we will allow ourselves to push it, and this is the opportunity in front of us now.
Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to support this today. I don't think in any stretch this is a magic bullet, but I think our franchise was to come to Salem and do interesting things. Granted, a lot of these things have not been interesting, but some are.
Just wait until we get to the lower part of the agenda.
I'm speaking primarily of the Facilities Committee when I say not all that interesting. So I enjoy these discussions. I think that ultimately the legislature, as we send this away, the legislature is going to put their fingerprints all over this, and perhaps they will decide that it is something that the people in the state should vote on. and that's fine. But, you know, we're here to engage in a discussion on things that either don't come easily to the legislature or don't come at all to the legislature. And so to me it is just an opportunity for us to continue a discussion that they may find hard to get back into. In general, I think that's what we're here to do, and that is realize that a number of these things are not perfect, and we cannot expect perfection coming out of this body necessarily. It will be perfected elsewhere for the most part. But at least it is something that moves things off dead center and spurs increased debate about something that that may have a positive impact on the process. So, again, I have no illusions about this being the final form that it will ultimately be in, if any. But nonetheless, I think what we do is important in the process, and I'll support it for that reason.
Mr. Harry.
The trouble with this meeting is that no matter what anybody says, it always makes sense to me. On this particular issue, that's the case, is that it really ultimately doesn't matter that much one way or the other. I think we've had examples of a very well-operating legislature that was elected on a highly partisan basis. And we've had examples more recently of a very partisan legislature that was elected by people voting on a ballot that hardly mentions. I mean, in none of their campaigns that I can remember did anybody say, well, I'm a Democrat, you ought to vote for me, or vice versa. In the campaigning, this is all suppressed. Not suppressed necessarily, but I mean ignored almost. And it seems to me that I think we can make this recommendation without any great harm. It might be helpful, as Commissioner Wilson says, so I think we probably ought to do it. But I don't think we ought to be overly optimistic as to the effect, because as I said earlier, I think the members of both bodies, they could have done this a long time ago if they really wanted to do it. In fact, they wouldn't have to do it if they wanted to behave in this way, in the way that we want. So I think this might be, I think the much more important recommendation is coming up in the next point, which has to do with the way that people are elected in the primary. If we do away with that, this previous discussion we've had for half an hour now, it really doesn't matter a whole lot, because we'll get a much better result much more easily, I think.
Mr. Burton.
I think we often like to think of ourselves as human beings, that we operate on our own volition and we know what we are and we act that way, which is patently false. As the washing hands in the bathroom studies have demonstrated, 80% of people do, women, men, when somebody else is in the room, and only 20% of people do when nobody else is in the room. So we are influenced by others. And I think the important part of this is the message, and sure, it's not as strong as some other proposal, but I think there's a limit on what we can accomplish here. I think there's a strong message that comes with this that is in behalf of ending or limiting or moderating the partisanship that exists. And I think people get influenced by those kinds of things, and it will have a meritorious effect on the legislature. So I'm in favor of doing it.
Commissioner Sheedy.
I'm going to vote in support of this measure if we do indeed take a vote, not so much because I'm sure that one or both houses should be nonpartisan, but because we are trying to make a statement about change. Some of the language that's been used in support of the action here is find a new organizing principle and vote for this in pursuit of a new organizing principle. And I think President Frommeyer characterized it as an experiment. So it's kind of odd to be voting for something like that. But I hope that this group has enough influence to prompt a new kind of conversation about our democracy, and at least people in the legislature would have a conversation because of this action taken that might continue to move us forward in the way that Representative Krieger and Representative Boone have suggested is positive.
Commissioner Staley.
I actually agree with Commissioner Schutte and Commissioner Merton that the value of this proposal isn't any structural change or anything like that. It is the idea of sending a message that we want people to behave in a slightly different manner. Having said that, I think the problem with the legislature or leadership or how bills get to the floor, don't get to the floor, and I'm going to look at Gary when I'm saying this, isn't about R&D. It's about the concentration of power vested in two individuals. And that's the elephant in the middle of the room that we have yet to pick up in this commission.
I want to make a comment here, and that is this. We're involved in a great debate over a system, and there's lots of pieces in this system. And unfortunately, we have to bring these pieces to the table one piece at a time. But each piece relates to other pieces. So one of the great tasks for all of us in this process is to try to keep in our minds the fact that this piece or another piece relate to each other. None of this are individual separated pieces and silos. They're part of a large governance system. So when we're talking about these pieces, there will be other things to come. So we will be building a body of work towards something. A recommendation to change or to consider change. Commissioner Lindy, you know, what we'll do is with Commissioner Lindy and then Commissioner Duncan and Commissioner Maris, and then I hope we will be able to get to a vote. Commissioner Lindy.
Oh, I only wanted to clarify a couple of things that were said earlier so you don't get them confused. We're not coming out saying House should do this or the Senate should do that or there should be nonpartisan. We're saying if they want to be, at present, there's no way for one House to do that. We ought to make it possible for them to do it. That's what Maya says. Now, some people have attacked this and saying, well, it doesn't go far enough. It's just a symbol. It's just sending a message. Well, I don't believe in just sending messages. I like to solve or to remove obstacles to solving problems, and this is removing one obstacle to one option that people might have. It's not world-shaking, so you can attack it on one side, not having much effect as well as originally did. Or you can say, no, it does have quite a bit of useful potential and be an opportunity, as Senator Gordley just said. Second, there's no reason why this couldn't be referred, if the legislature wanted to, refer the statute to the voters. That'd be easy. You know, they could do that. You don't have to amend the Constitution. It'd be anomalous to stick something in the Constitution on parties when there hadn't been anything before about it. I mean, you don't need to do that. But as far as getting a vote of the public's concerned, that's no problem at all. You can refer any bill to a vote if you think that would make you feel better about it. So basically, you know, there's this kind of working uphill here through a status quo mentality. We know how it works now. If we just all got along better, got back to the good old days when people had better personal relationships, and maybe we gained that again. Maybe some of us individually have had that experience now. Why don't we just all go and play nicely together? And I think that is unrealistic. I mean, I don't want to repeat what Dave Pohlmeier said, but the game has changed, the money has changed, the results of gaining control and what that means change. It's not the same game anymore. And we shouldn't pretend that it's just a matter of personal behavior. Finally, one more thing. We said earlier we have barely enough votes for quorum. This is an interesting discussion. And it does relate to other issues, as our co-chair said, that come along that we haven't packaged together as an issue, but they are under consideration in the process committee. So if anybody thinks we shouldn't vote today and they want to postpone it for another discussion, that's an option that's open, as we are told. be better to do that than to vote it down on false assumption as to what it is you're voting on. I hope we'll eventually pass this.
Commissioner Duncan.
Yes, I'm going to support this measure because I think we need to keep the issue in front of us and in front of the public. And it may not be ready to go to a full constitutional amendment at this point. But moving forward on it also doesn't relieve our own legislators from doing exactly as they've described today, seeking more and more ways in which to be bipartisan. But one of the most important things I think we can do with this is by having this measure in front of the public, in front of ourselves, in front of the legislature, is to begin to discuss campaign finance reform with a different kind of lens and a different kind of vision. And that's why I'm supporting it.
Commissioner Ramirez.
Thank you. I will be supporting this recommendation. Having seen the process where the efforts of the legislature is to bring forward the best public policy, surround that public policy for the benefit of Oregonians, when you look at the party affiliation of who sponsored what bill, et cetera, coming forward, a lot of bills go by the wayside that would benefit the public. I see this effort as a way to address that and hopefully through the process continue to strengthen the legislature. I think our efforts here are what can we do to strengthen our legislative leaders. And I appreciate the work and effort that's gone into this, and we can debate this and discuss it forever. But the next topic that we're going to be addressing here, I think, is going to address our overall effort in this conversation.
Thank you. I would entertain a motion.
I move that we accept the recommendation of the committee.
Yes.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. I will ask Kelly if she will call the roll.
Careless?
Aye.
Bernstein excused, Representative Hume?
Aye.
Bronner excused, Burns?
Aye.
Cease?
No.
Craig excused, Duncan?
Aye.
Frohnmeyer?
Aye.
Garber excused, Senator Bluntman?
Aye.
Harry?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Carmel?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Lang excused, Latimer?
Aye.
Leeson excused, Lindy?
Aye.
Merton?
Yes.
Senator Morris excused, Pixley excused, Sheriff Ramirez?
Aye.
Shumi?
Aye.
Seeley?
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Thank you. Thank
Would you,
you
announce the vote, please?
I'm sorry. I didn't. It passed.
With how many?
18. Thank you very much for the debate. Now we'll move on to another debate, which is related. I want to remind you of something. When we talk about partisanship in Parliament, the two sides are exactly three sword lengths apart. We aren't here yet. All right. The next proposal is proposal number 98 for open primary elections. And Ms. Carmel, would you take us through this, please?
I will. What I'll do first is to give you a little background on the proposal, then propose a motion to you as a result of the committee's recommendation, and then make a brief statement of support to make sure we meet Commissioner Wilson's test of important. At the April committee meeting of the process committee, we examined Initiative 86, currently seeking signatures to be put on the ballot. We heard from proponents, Phil Kiesling and Norma Paulus. We heard from opponents, Barbara Roberts and Grattan Cairns. I'm going to read from the two short paragraphs from the information supplied by the proponents. The first, the proposal for the Oregon open primary. And let me note that you have in the materials distributed ahead of time staff's general summary, both of the proposal and of the and other states' practices. The proponents state the following. All candidates appear on the same primary ballot with their party affiliation noted, and all voters receive the same ballot. The top two vote-getters, regardless of party affiliation, advance to appear on the general election ballot. The measure would open the primary for all currently partisan officers, from legislators, governor, and other statewide offices, to U.S. senator and representative. The problem that this proposal addresses: the existing primary system deprives all Oregonians of full and equal choice in selecting our key leaders. The system also allows narrow interests to exercise disproportionate power in closed primary elections. This exacerbates partisanship and discourages civil conversation and creative solutions to our major problems. The open primary shifts the focus of elections back to forming a winning coalition of all voters, not just those who turn up in a party in a partisan primary. As I say, we heard testimony from both proponents and opponents. At the May committee meeting of the process committee, we had an informative and lengthy discussion both of the specific initiative being proposed by Kiesling and Paulus and the general concept of opening the primary to all registered voters, which primaries are currently reserved for two of the two major parties. We deliberated a wide range of pros and cons, of concerns and opportunities, such as the disenfranchising of unaffiliated and minor party voters. And I will digress to say that in the recent sad turnout primary, if I have the numbers right, roughly 770,000 voters, Oregonians, voted in those two in the primaries. The unaffiliated and minor party candidates are 510,000 voters who were banned from participating in the primary election. Banned, not allowed to vote. We discussed the impact on election cycle and the length of that cycle. We discussed candidate behavior in the primary versus candidate behavior in the general, which I will characterize as zigzag, which is zig for the primary and zag for the general. We discussed the implications for right of association. We discussed practices in other states with respect to primary partisanship. We talked about scenarios to reduce excessive partisanship, and we talked about the role of the party, particularly the majority party, in the leadership. The longest discussion in our deliberation was about Section 10.3 of the initiative, which has to do with what the party's right to determine who shall and shall not be allowed to use the party label, the R or D label. It became clear in our discussions that there are many possible scenarios about what would change in an open primary environment. I have Republican friends and Democratic friends who write different scenarios, some of whom support and some of whom don't support. In this sense, it is almost nonpartisan, since I find as much support among Democrats as among Republicans and vice versa. You have the staff summary. I'd like to make the personal comment, if it sounds a little pontificating, it probably is, that I believe that it is the job of this commission to change the story of the legislature, to change the story from rancor, partisanship, excessive partisanship, loss of public confidence, to a new way of doing business. Yesterday, the Oregonian editorial wrote, "An entire generation of political candidates only papered over big issues. That just won't do anymore." I believe that we, this commission, can make a major step forward in rewriting and writing a new story, changing the story for the legislature. I also want to take note of a speech Adam Davis made to the City Club about a couple of weeks ago. He is the partner of Tim Hibbetts, as you know, our former commissioner on this commission. His speech to the City Club, and I wonder if staff can obtain a transcript of this. I think you'll find it very interesting. But the title of his speech was "The Perfect Storm of Public Opinion in Oregon." And he mentioned five meteorological conditions of the storm, the top three of which were, first, public cynicism, negativism, and skepticism. And I've heard some of that in this room this morning, I might add. Decreasing awareness and knowledge about government was the second. The third, no confidence in leadership, and by that Adam meant the leadership of the government, the leadership in communities, the leadership of the business sector, coming from national scandals about business leadership in part. And he elaborated on each of the five meteorological conditions. At the end of his speech, he said, "But there are rays of hope. And one of the rays of hope is the work of this commission," and he specifically mentioned the open primary, annual sessions, and the nonpartisan recommendation that we have just voted on. I believe it is never easy to change the story of any life or organization or entity, but that it's important for us to do this. We have taken as a commission some good first steps on annual sessions, the retiming of sessions, and time limits. We made a good step this morning endorsing legislative consideration of nonpartisan election, and I feel particularly passionately about the 510,000 souls who are not allowed to vote in primaries. So with that statement of both personal and committee support, the committee recommends to you that the commission endorse. Your handout says support, but the word is endorse. Endorse an open primary. Not specifically 86, but certainly not excluding 86. Thank you.
Thank you. Discussion to the recommendation.
Just a question, if you could characterize the differences in your recommendation, or is there a difference, or are you just making a statement that you don't necessarily support Initiative 86? Is there something that is bothering the committee with?
Yeah, the committee voted 6-1 to endorse the concept, the general approach of an open primary. The discussion about this one section, and Secretary Kiesling is in the room if you'd like him to explain what that one section is. I call it out because that was the reason that the committee preferred to endorse the concept rather than endorsing a specific initiative.
Commissioner Steele. Did you get your question?
I'm not sure. I did get
that before.
The committee didn't want to go quite as far as endorsing the issue. In addition to which, Commissioner Frohnmayer pointed out that we didn't want to get even close to the corrupt practices piece of it.
Okay.
Let's hear from a couple of the committee members. Commissioner Frohnmayer, would you like to talk about this?
I don't know that I have much to add. I thought Commissioner Kimmel's explanation was masterful. I certainly agree with this and have for several dozen decades. It seems like a long time. The only caveat is the one that was just mentioned, and I don't know that it's anything more than abundance of caution, but inasmuch as this may be a ballot measure and inasmuch as we are a state entity, to endorse formally that measure might run us too close to the election laws, and we thought that was both unwise and unnecessary because the concept of the primary is sufficiently compelling that it ought to stand or fall quite apart from whatever is before us on the ballot.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Wilhelms has a clarification question.
Well, there was a reference made to a section that the committee did not agree with.
The committee felt it shouldn't. It was a difficult section of the proposed of Initiative 86 about which we had a lot of discussion. We didn't necessarily agree or disagree, but the committee felt more comfortable endorsing concept of the open primary rather than the initiative that contains Section 10.3, which, as I understand it, is responding to a legal concern,
yes.
which I do not plead an understanding of.
What is that?
Perhaps Commissioner Lindy.
Commissioner Lindy.
Well, what the section seems to do, and there's disagreement as to how it would work, is to permit the party central committees to withhold the right to run as a Republican or a Democrat.
I
wish I had the text here in front of me. I'd much prefer to be able to read you what the particular section says, but the controversy and the doubt concerns whether it would be possible for a party central committee. Where is it? Okay, here we've got it. All right. Thank you. Thank you. It says a party may notify the chief elections officer that a candidate for nomination to a voter choice office has been determined by the party to be ineligible to be listed on the ballot as a member of the political party in accordance with party rules. That kind of introduces the idea of a non-governmental entity, that is to say, a political party outside the legislature, group of people who are organized as Democrats, Republicans, to disqualify somebody. And there was some concern expressed, not in the committee, but outside people being concerned that this would be tempting for a Democratic pro-life candidate simply to be disqualified from running as a Democrat, or vice versa, if you had the opposite position on some Republican issue, that the Central Committee might try to disqualify somebody by some rules. It's a little doubtful whether the text really calls for that kind of cherry-picking of people's positions, but it was enough doubt that we thought this particular sentence involved the political parties, which are not governmental bodies, in the identification of people who want to identify themselves as Democrats or Republicans and be on the ballot for their constituency to vote yes or no on their nomination.
Commissioner Seeley.
I have concerns about this measure. I guess I would have rather have seen something come out that strongly encourages both parties to open up their primaries to independent voters. And I'm going to say this as A, woman, B, hopefully still a youngish woman, and someone who would like to see diversity in the legislature. I'm also going to say this as someone who is married to somebody who lost in a primary by 13 votes, who I think would have benefited from this exact thing had it been law at the time. But a woman won in a four-person primary with three guys and a woman, won by 13 votes. I have grave concerns about the amount of money that's going to be needed. And I say this as a practitioner of elections. You have to double your mailing plan to mail to a larger pool of voters. I worry about what that means to young people wanting to serve in office, to women, to people of color who don't always have access to the interest groups that we all know exist. I think that there are ways to deal with that. I think first and foremost, changing the date of the primary. And the idea of doing this, and I'll say this having had two campaigns run out of my house, if you told me you were going to have to reach the entire pool of voters by May, you have to start campaigning. If you believe in grassroots democracy and door knocking, you got to start door knocking in like September, August to meet that many people. I just have strong concerns.
Commissioner Merton.
Sorry, I must have been hand waving. Your hands in my pocket.
Senator Cordley.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Strongly in support of the initiative 86, and also supported the proposal coming out of our committee. Because we have Mr. Kiesling present, I'm wondering, Madam Chair, if we could hear his comments on that technical piece, Section 10, I think it is, that seemed to cause some concern, or did cause some concern in our committee. Would he wish to address that piece, offer any other comments?
Mr. Kiesling, would you like to come up, please?
Madam Chair, Senator and Commissioner Gordley, and members of the committee, Section 10.3 is in there for one reason and one reason only. A court decision in the Washington case last summer suggested that that parties may have this right since they're private associations under the U.S. Supreme Court decisions. And so putting rules around the use of the label and the parties use thereof is what this does. It's a confining piece of language because it's subject to the administrative rules process. Personally, if we didn't think we needed to have it, I would have thrown it out. But when you make a decision, and we did, that voters should be able to see the party registration of the candidates. It's public information. We pay money to collect that information. Parties certainly like it to know who is officially affiliated with them. But as long as you believe that should be on the ballot to give voters that piece of important information, we believe legally you need language like this to prevent, to in a sense have the highest level of confidence in it surviving a court challenge. We have other sections in Section 10 that would do that. If a court decision comes out that suggests that this is unnecessary language to accomplish the purpose, quite honestly, I'd be in favor of getting rid of it. But we did not want to go to the trouble of getting 100,000 signatures, doing an initiative that is, we think, a very powerful way to change the basic rules of politics, and leave that particular thing to chance. So that's why Section 10.3 is in there. And, of course, this recommendation is not to endorse this specific measure, including Section 10.3, but to endorse the concept. And I very much hope this body does that. Does that clarify things?
Yes. I believe the co-chair has a question.
If the measure passes, then I understand that each candidate listed on the ballot will have a label, a party label.
It will be listed member of blank party, member of blank party.
It will not say that they are green or independent or D or R. It actually removes that from the ballot as well.
No. What would be listed, and it's in Section 10, member of blank political party. So I would be member of Democratic Party.
Okay.
Some would be member of Republican Party, member of Libertarian Party, and if they're not, they would be listed as independent.
It just enables then two D's or two R's or two I's or whoever gets the most votes to end up going on to the general.
Top two regardless.
But they would be identified. Okay. Second question. When you talked about the Administrative Procedures Act applying, does that mean then in this case that the 10.3 section that's in question could be clarified or there could be rules drafted around that by the Secretary of State?
Yes.
To clarify exactly how far the party could go with that language.
Yes, Commissioner Wilhelms, and the section also puts in timelines also around that specific provision.
Thank you.
Any more questions for
Bill?
I didn't identify myself. Phil Kiesling, 3408 Southeast 8, Portland.
With Mr. Co-Chair's question, so if people can identify themselves with member of whatever party it is, does the initiative say that they have to, that the party that they identify has to have qualified under Oregon law as a party, or can they just make up a party, or what are the requirements for that in this initiative?
Commissioner Cease, good question. It would be a existing legal party under Oregon law. We currently, I believe, have two majors, Democrat, Republican, and three minors, Libertarian, Pacific Green, and Constitution.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, questions first?
Yes, thank you. Hi, Phil.
On this initiative, can a
candidate win outright in the primary?
No. It is a top two situation. Okay, the top two would proceed to November. Right, and that is a difference from a nonpartisan election under existing Oregon law where one can win outright.
Mr. Baird's question? All right. Representative Krieger, questions for Mr. Baird?
Just briefly, if you only have two candidates, you still got to run it off a second time?
Correct.
Mr. Merton, questions for Mr. Baird?
Commissioner Seeley spoke about her reservations from a campaign financing standpoint. What do you have to say about those concerns?
Commissioner Merton, this is not a campaign finance reform measure. I strongly believe in campaign finance reform and have supported strongly two ballot measures to that effect. I think it is one of the biggest challenges we all face. I don't know the effect that it will have. I certainly, believe that it will mean more competition. There will be more races that will not be decided in May. I dare say with 75 legislative seats in contest, theoretically, this cycle, how many of those are really in play? More and more elections are decided in the primary election in districts that are heavily one way or another. If the legislature were representative of the population, 21 members would be not Democrat or Republican. Not the case. So to the extent that there may be more competition and more races, overall amounts of money may go up. But then the question is, in a given race, what will happen? I think this gives candidates a chance to speak to every voter from the beginning and talk about issues that matter to most voters. And I don't think that's always the case right now. But who knows? But I would very strongly support campaign finance reform in combination with this. I think it's an amazing 1-2 punch, but that's not the issue before you now.
Any more questions for, yes, Senator Gordon?
Thank you. Speaking to one of Commissioner Seeley's concerns, Mr. Kiesling, what evidence is there that an open primary would diminish the opportunities for women and people of color?
Commissioner Gordley, I don't see any evidence of that. In fact, I think that it will, mean more diversity in people that run. I mean, right now, if you're under 35, near as we can tell, none of the above is the single biggest category of voter registration. So young people who have said no to each of the two major political parties, they would have, I think, a viable chance to run and be a factor and potentially be elected. You have an issue right now. If you have to wait until November, then you instantly get into a spoiler problem, arguably. And I think that actually makes it harder for them and their views to be part of it. Again, evidence that we have, it is a few years old, but that the median age of people who actually cast ballots in a primary election now is close to 60. And I think that has an effect on what is talked about and what isn't talked about. And I think this will encourage more people to step forward and of a more diverse nature and run. And I think prevail in more cases than they can now.
Are there any more questions for Mr. Kiesling? Thank you very much. Thank you. All right. We'll go back to the list that we had before Mr. Kiesling was kind enough to answer some questions. Senator Gorley, were you finished?
Yes, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Commissioner Lanneman.
I was just going to move the committee report, but if there are other people who want to speak, that's fine.
Okay. Commissioner Duncan and then Commissioner Seeley. And we had Commissioner Herring on the list, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to clarify for this group that the recommendation coming out of the process committee does not deal with the specifics of this measure that we just spent some time on. It really is a policy statement about the value of open primaries.
Thank you. Commissioner Herring.
I support this recommendation. When you really think about it, I'm not sure if we're going far enough. When you have to sometimes ask yourself why we have primaries in the first place. I mean, especially if we're not going to have partisan primaries, then what's the point of nominating elections at all? Why don't we just do away with it? But I think that's another topic, and we're not prepared to address it now. But I think one step, certainly one that makes a lot of sense, is to get the idea of, it seems to me that we've been running elections for, as Phil says, for private organizations. And you have to wonder why. Why doesn't the state pay for primary elections for the constitutional party and so on? So I think by getting rid of the partisan labels in the primary, that question is resolved.
Thank you. Commissioner Seeley.
I'd like to ask Commissioner Hill a question. And obviously, he's experienced our system most recently. And so I hope I put you on the spot a little bit. And in terms, if this law were in effect when you made your decision 6-8 months ago, what would have been your thinking about being willing to run? What would it have changed some of the questions that you would have had to ask yourself or your organization?
Well, for me, I am a Democrat for a reason. I think it's important when voters decide to cast their ballot that they know what the person stands for. One thing, because it's been our system for so long, people understand the difference between Republican and Democrat for the most part, I would say. I don't know if it would have changed how I would approach things. Now, I guess the one question that I would have is that I understand in the measure, Measure 86, that there is an identification of what the party is. In this proposal, is that the case as well?
No.
Well, I have to say, I think that someone's party, I have no problem with the open primary concept, but I do believe that people should know what a person's party affiliation is, because it does give you some very basic information as to where somebody leans. So if this is the case, then I'm not sure that I can support this, because I guess it's a question. When you have a turnout of 30-some-odd percent, maybe people don't care about anything. But I think people who want to cast a ballot should know what a person's party affiliation is or whether they're independent, because that gives them at least some kind of a threshold indication of where people stand. So I would comment on the money aspect of it, campaign spending. We were outspent pretty heavily, and what your comments, Commissioner Seeley, about the amount of money that you have to spend on campaigns, that does give you some pause in terms of mailings and so forth and the amount of outreach that you have. It certainly increases the cost. And with vote by mail, most people don't think of vote by mail. So vote by mail increases the cost of elections too, because you have to aim for a period, not just an election day. You have to have something going the entire time from the time that the ballots go out until election day. So it would increase, it would give an advantage, I think, to those who have money and those versus those who don't. I guess for me it really does come down to, I have no problem with the concept of an open primary, but I think that the idea of not knowing what a person's party affiliation is pretty basic. I guess from a practical standpoint, for someone who's been, the money is an issue. How much money do you have to run a campaign is an issue. But I have no problem with the concept myself of an open primary.
Ms. Carmel, and then I'm going to go back over here to Mr. Latimer.
Two quick points. One of which is that the proposal of the committee is silent with respect to whether there should be a party label or not be a party label. It's not that it says no party label. Secondly, and this is a much more general comment to the commission as a whole, the process committee, with I think modestly not including me, but the process committee has some very good heads, and we spent hours on this. So I want to encourage the commission to have, particularly with a strong vote in our case 6-1, to have confidence in its committees to have done a thorough job of vetting proposals. And the committee brings to you a strongly voted endorse open primary concept recommendation.
Mr. Latimer, I don't believe you did make your motion.
No,
I think
I
you gave the courtesy to everyone to continue the discussion.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the committee's recommendation before the commission. I think this, quite frankly, is one of the most important things we'll do.
Is there a second?
Second.
Kelly, will you call the roll, please?
Is that further discussion?
I'm going to pass, if I may, for the moment.
Okay. Just a moment of further discussion. Would it be possible to just clarify what you mean then by the concept of the open primary? I'm compelled by Commissioner Hill's comments to make sure I understand what is included in the recommendation.
That there be an open primary is distinct from a closed primary.
Are there any more questions to what it is we're voting on? To the motion.
Yes.
Because the word is used in the motion and it's been used in the questions, it's worth understanding what an open primary means. And all it means is that it's open to all voters, all registered voters, to cast a ballot in that primary, the nominating cycle, regardless of their own party registration. And that's the concept, and that's we know. What you should know, and I agree with what former Secretary of State Kiesling said, is that this is a constitutionally very difficult thing to design without running into trouble. Because primaries were originally a substitution for having party structures through central committees and so on, put candidates on state ballot. Until 1870, there were no state ballots. We operated without state ballots. Once they had to start printing ballots, then they had to find out whose name is going to be on the ballot. And then they had the party organizations. And then they said, no, Democratic Reform right here in Oregon, we're going to make this a vote of all registered people in that party. So that the idea was that primaries were originally designed to give party members a chance to nominate people of their own party. The open primary, and then had the consequences which we now deplore, which is that people who don't want to commit themselves to one party or the other don't get to have a voice at all in the nomination process. There must be 20 court cases taking apart details of specific open primary laws around the country. It's a hard thing to bring off because you're choosing a nominee ostensibly on behalf of the voters in that party while letting people who are not voters in that party cast a vote on the same nominee at the same time. That's not easy to square up. What we are in favor of is, in other words, the principle, yes, we should take a look and have a decent analysis of what is the best system that will permit voters to vote in a primary while at the same time allowing, and then we would like to have the opportunity, of course, if it's legally possible, to have the voter know the party registration of the candidates who appear on that ballot. That's the principle you're voting in favor of.
Thank you. Do you have a question to the motion?
Yeah, and that's what I was wondering, looking for a clear definition of open if the motion is not for the specific initiative 86. So, and I think that you answered it. If that's the case, if that's what we're voting on, just open to all people to vote on all the candidates. But wait, one more thing. Does that mean then still that the top two vote getters advance? That's where I have the rub with me. So is that part of the definition of open? Is that the top two? Okay.
No.
It's just everybody gets to vote.
It isn't necessarily. It's a good design. I have no objection to the design in Measure 86. But let me tell you something. How these systems get into trouble is that people got to vote in different, I mean, there's a Washington system was thrown out. California got in real trouble. You may remember in the 19, well, you may not remember it, but you may have heard that in the 1940s and 50s, California would have people nominated. I mean, Earl Warren would win both primaries. He'd win the Democratic primary. He'd run a double trial. There are all kinds of different designs for this thing that have been used elsewhere. But the difficulty was that if you got to pick a Republican for one race, vote for the Republican nominee in one office, and then switch over to the other column and vote for the Democratic nominee, to be on the final ballot, on the November ballot, with a party designation of the other party, that then the Supreme Court said, now you are allowing people who are not party members to, in effect, pick the party nominee for November. So designing something that... That's why I can't answer your question. Is there a... Do we have a definition of an open primary? We haven't designed such a bill, but they exist, and some of them have passed muster, and maybe this one would, too.
Representative, do you have any more questions to the motion?
No.
Members to the motion.
It is potentially possible that voting for this, we could end up with a system like Montana. Because although it might not be called an open primary, it is kind of speaking to our intention, which was to allow those disillusioned voters that can't participate in the primary to participate.
Well, you'd have to tell me what Montana's is.
You just pick a party ballot. Nobody records who picks which one. I could pick a Republican ballot and vote in the primary. I just only get one ballot, but everyone gets the chance to pick a ballot.
Could I ask you a question? Does that include, Bridget, independents? Can they get a partisan ballot?
Yeah, it does. That was my sister's issue.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so my thought was that there are, just like you said, lots of potential solutions out there that could work for us, and we're not deciding it, but I just wanted to make sure that was one of the possibilities.
Plus, I know.
Okay. I'm from Montana.
Are there any more questions to the motion?
Madam Chair, to my motion. I think it's important to understand that what we're doing is recommending here in this commission the concept of an open primary. I happen to think that Measure 86 is a good structure and will be adopted by the people of Oregon. You can create other structures, but it would be very difficult, it seems to us, to come before you. And maybe we could, but I don't know whether that would be appropriate for this commission to adopt a particular measure. What we're doing, if we adopt this motion, is the concept of open primary. I will vote for Measure 86. I think it's a good structure, and it will pass legal muster. But there are other ways to do it.
The measure is not before us. What's before us is simply to support an open primary election by recommending it to the Oregon legislature. Are there any more questions to the motion? Kelly, please call the roll.
If I may, I'd like to explain my vote before I cast it. This, for every reason that my good friend John Lattimore has said he favors it, I'm going to vote no, because I truly do believe the devil is in the details of anything. And I support ballot measure 86. But I don't know what I'm voting for here. And there are ways you could construct this that I would be 1,000% opposed to. And so I can't vote for a pig in a poke, and so I'm going to have to vote no, in spite of the 6-1 vote of the committee. I apologize for that.
Please proceed.
And after hearing, I have to explain myself, too. After
hearing that, sorry about that.
If I can qualify it, that I'm voting for an open primary, meaning everybody gets a vote, but as Commissioner Barrows has said, I'm still not clear on what that open means. So I guess holding my nose, I'll vote yes, but hoping that it just truly means open.
Bronner, excuse. Burns?
Yes.
Cease?
Aye.
Gray, excuse. Duncan?
Aye.
Strohmeyer?
Aye.
Garber, excuse. Senator Gordon?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Carmel?
Yes.
Representative
Krieger? Aye.
Lenny, excuse, Latimer?
Aye.
Beeson, excuse, Lindy?
Yes.
Burton?
Yes.
Senator Morse, excuse, Pinsley, excuse, Sheriff Ramirez?
Aye.
Schutte?
Aye.
Seeley?
No.
Sinchuk, excuse, Wilson?
Aye.
Yoshida, excuse, Co-Chair Fryer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Wilhelm?
Aye.
18-4 and 2
yes.
How many with the nose? Two no. So this passes.
Could I be here?
Please.
The only thing that I wish was added to this report was a retiming of the primary election, as long as we're talking about primary elections. I would really like to see a recommendation come out to move the primary to September.
Reduce the cost.
Well, it's still on the agenda.
Reduce the cost.
All right. I'd like to be able to have us take a very brief break. 5 minutes. Please try to keep to that and get back to so that we can finish the next two committee recommendations before lunch. Thank you.
Right here.
Good morning. This is Laura.
Hey, Laura. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing just fine.
Good. Well, we're trying to get everybody rounded up and get them back in here so we can get started.
Okay.
You know, when I moved to Oregon, I registered as an independent. And the reason why, when I was in rural school in Indiana, when I was in school in Indiana, you could go into the voting and get one waiver and vote the entire ticket, Republican or Democrat. You didn't have to look at them. And I was like, you got it. And I just didn't know what it was like here. And so I said, I'm going to register as an independent and get kind of the lay of the land politically. Hello, Jane.
And we have Commissioner Carrie Kinchuk on the phone. And the next committee to make recommendation is the Public Institution Committee. Proposal 78 about alcohol in the Capitol. Carrie, would you like to walk us through this?
Sure would. Good morning, Commissioners, and thanks for allowing me to participate. Via the phone, the Public Institution Committee met last week to discuss a number of items, one of which was the item before you today. At a number of our meetings, we heard testimony from Steve Dole of Crime Victims United and Ann Pratt, who was also with Crime Victims United, of an incident that has received some notoriety during the last legislative session, when during the last days of the session, again from Mr. Dole's and Ms. Pratt's testimony, they were in the Capitol hoping to get a last-minute passage of a bill that dealt, ironically enough, with driving while under the influence of intoxicants, Ms. Pratt's child being a victim of a drunk driver. They ran into an incident when, as they were lobbying for the bill in the last hours, last days of the session, they had to deal with legislators who they did not name and never have named, who they believed were themselves under the influence of intoxicants. And this came as a awful shock to Ms. Pratt, who's a citizen activist. She and Mr. Dole began an effort to do something about that and thought that the committee was a good way to raise this issue. They talked with our committee about a number of proposals they had, one of which would set up some sort of legal system, a policy requiring members to report other members who they believed were under the influence, and a warning system. Your committee, our subcommittee, believed this was unworkable for a number of reasons, but we did believe that the charge before our committee is to improve the public image of the legislature, and certainly having legislators who are legislating while under the influence is not a good thing for the image of the legislature. So we worked with Mr. Dole and Ms. Pratt, and we unanimously approved the recommendation that is before you today, which just would ask the leadership of the House and Senate to send a strong message to their members by rule that being under the influence while on the job of a legislature is certainly not appropriate.
Thank you, Carrie. Is there any discussion to this motion? I mean, to this, to this recommendation?
I have a question in reference in regards to this motion. Are we just limiting it to intoxication, because intoxication refers to that they're under the influence versus consumption, which doesn't necessarily reach to the level of intoxication, prohibiting any consumption of alcohol, you know, at the capital. So I ask that question for clarification.
The question comes from Commissioner Ramirez.
Right. No, I think as the motion says, it says under the influence or intoxicated. It would be hard to certainly police any consumption of a glass of wine or beer at a reception or whatever. And given the hours of the legislature, we thought that might be being a little too big brotherish. But certainly a rule from the Speaker and the President of the Senate. I mean, it's common sense, obviously, but just reminding the legislators that being under the influence of intoxicants while on the job is not what we want from our public servants.
Mr. Herring, would you like to make any comments in the committee?
Well, I wanted to answer the question, but it's been answered, so that was fine.
All right, thank you. Are there any more questions?
To Sheriff Ramirez's point, it does say from being intoxicated. Does the committee mean that means being under the influence of intoxicants, or is it a problem if it's worded differently, or am I just being picky?
Commissioner Herring.
The answer is yes, you're being picky.
So it's the same thing.
As somebody who asked some of those questions, who was initially a little skeptical of this proposal, let me say that it is probably not necessary to dot every particular I in this idea. Every workplace that we know of has some sort of a rule against being intoxicated on the job, and they don't necessarily define what that is by some sort of a blood alcohol level or anything else. We don't want to go that far, but we clearly understand that when a constituent comes to the Capitol and finds somebody who is either incoherent or making no sense or really reeking of alcohol in a terrible way, that makes a very bad impression, and we think that the leadership ought to act to remind members that this is unacceptable. We did not specify any particular language. We figured that experts in that field could do that. But we do want to emphasize the point that it really is unacceptable to have people on legislative duty who are clearly not in themselves. And that's all.
Okay.
I guess the issue around this particular topic, and I'm glad it's before us, is the issue of dual standards. We have an expectation, the citizens have an expectation of government employees to act accordingly, et cetera, which means on government property, government time, you don't consume alcohol to whatever degree, or have it on the premises. So the question was, there discussion around the dual standards here that it's allowed in the state capitol, a public building, but yet prohibited it everywhere else. That's a government facility, et cetera, et cetera. So I pose that question, I mean, because that's exactly what the public expects of us while on duty in whatever government capacity, that we follow the rules. So
We did discuss that, and we had a briefing from Dave Henderson, legislative administrator, on the alcohol policy in the Capitol, which is a very structured process of how you get approved to have an event that has alcohol in the Capitol. It's after hours. It has to end at a certain time. Has to be only like wine and beer. It's for some sort of, for the receptions that they have there. The committee talks. We don't want to go into the business of recommending that the House and Senate ban alcohol from the Capitol, because again, that would put an end to those type of receptions, which are held in the Capitol after hours. Nor did we want to get in the business of recommending that they ban alcohol, period, from everywhere, every corner of the Capitol. Again, we were uncomfortable with acting as a nanny here in this instance. And again, so much of this is common sense, and just we felt that we would be making the proper statement by raising this issue and by urging the leadership to just remind their members by rule, and again, they can enact whatever rule, if they could word it differently, that that alcohol and legislating don't mix.
Mr. Henderson is here. Dave, do you want to come up so we can ask you some questions, if anybody would like to? For the record, you are?
Dave Henderson, legislative administrator.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions, Dave, about how it works now in the Capitol?
I don't have a question, but I might prompt you to talk a little bit about the dual standard question that Commissioner Ramirez has raised. Within the current standards, it is permissible for an individual legislator to pour a glass of wine in their office whenever they choose.
Chair Pryor, Commissioner Schuette, the state capitol is one of, I believe, only three buildings that are exempted from the prohibition on alcohol in state buildings. The Department of Agriculture is also exempt from that, and I believe Economic Development, but I'm not certain of that. So at this point, yes, it is entirely legal for a legislator to have a beer, a glass of wine in their office. In the public areas of the Capitol, as Commissioner Timchuk said, we have very structured policies on allowing serving of alcohol. And I did check just this morning to confirm this. In the prior calendar year, 2005, there were only four instances where we approved permits to serve alcohol. And so far this year, there have only been two instances approved. So it's in the public areas. It is a very limited activity.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Mr. Henderson, the agencies that are exempt, including this this institution, what is that history? Why?
Commissioner Pryor, Senator Gordley, the reason for the Department of Agriculture, at least one of the reasons, is that the state wine cellar is located in that building, and I believe they do conduct events where, as wine is one of the agricultural products of the state, they may actually serve some. Economic Development, I'm not certain of that, but I suspect it would be the same idea, that as that office is responsible for promoting economic development, there may be instances where serving Oregon products would be appropriate. I cannot speak as to why the Capitol itself was excluded, but that is a rule that was adopted by the Department of Administrative Services regulating the service in buildings that they control.
Senator Gorley, I can give you a little clarification, mm-hmm. I think, about the, and that goes back to the foreign trade teams. There was a time when Oregon was very involved in bringing foreign trade teams in, and it was usual practice to offer sake or something from that country, or offer something that we had here, but it was with respect to a formal occasion of a trade team originally. But I don't know beyond that.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I believe the university system is also exempt
because I know there are interdependents with licensees who provide those at least a couple of the universities.
I think so. I mean, it's always done under licensing from the OLCC, so that's always supervised, but it has been done on numerous occasions.
Are there any more questions for Mr. Henderson? Yes, Commissioner Lindy.
No, I just wanted to, not about the building, but the motion before us, the proposal before us,
right.
Isn't
Thank
about
you.
The building. It's
Thank
a,
you very much.
I'm asking if the
no.
committee proposal isn't about the building.
Well, you're right. It doesn't particularly talk about the building because, as we know, legislators also perform legislative duties away from here at hearings, field hearings, and that sort of thing. We had very convincing testimony, though, that concerned this particular building. Convincing testimony to the effect that constituents were put off by legislators being drunk. That I think is what the committee is trying to help put a stop to, if it's possible.
Madam Chair, here's why I asked the question. The committee recommendation is about being intoxicated while performing the duties, and you could go downtown, have 7 martinis, and come back to work. Maybe you could come back to work. But if you showed up, and this is a serious question, that is, would you be prevented from voting on the floor?
Absolutely. We did not endorse or recommend a particular list of sanctions, but we do want the leadership of both houses to make a strong statement in the rules, and they can develop whatever rules they have in mind. I think there may be the witnesses we had, they had specific recommendations for fines and being expelled and that sort of thing. We did not endorse those specifics,
no.
But we do think that the leadership and that both houses can develop rules that make some sense and that emphasize the point that simply you ought not to be drunk while you're working.
Okay, thank you.
Earlier, Mr. Herring mentioned that legislators under the influence making no sense in front of their constituents. I might remind you, it's been my experience that legislators don't have to be under the
All right. I'm going to ask Mr. Barrows if he'd like to make a motion.
Madam Chair, would move that the commission adopt the committee's recommendation. As proposed.
I second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. Kelly, will you please read and call the roll?
Yes.
Bernstein excused, Representative
Newman.
Yes. Bronner excused, Burns excused, Stevens.
Aye.
Craig excused, Duncan.
Aye.
Stromeyer.
Aye.
Darker excused, and
Dworkin. In my experience, this has been a problem. We have had members vote while drunk. It has been an issue. Aye.
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Bernal?
Yes.
Representative Krieger?
I've only had tea today.
Lang excused,
Latimer? Aye.
Wiesen excused, Lindy?
Yes.
Merton?
Yes.
Senator Morris excused, Pigley excused, Sheriff Ramirez?
Aye.
Judy?
Aye.
Seeley?
Aye.
Timchuk?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye.
Aye.
20 aye votes. This will move forward as a recommendation. Thank you very much. All right. Thank you, Chair Timchuk.
You're welcome, Madam Pryor.
Go have a nice lunch and watch what you drink.
No, okay.
Well, this applies to commission members, too.
Yeah, that's right.
right. We need to move on to the Facilities Committee, who has a number of recommendations for us. And Commissioner Wilson, will you help us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will. Mindful that lunch is 45 minutes away, we'll get to work here. Gradually, we've moved from the ethereal to the concrete here, and so give us something to get your hands dirty on here, which will probably be good for the soul. All right, let's take a look at proposals 12 and 13 here, if you would. I'm going to do these in block, if you don't mind. We're going to recommend no further action be taken on these two issues. Item number 12 is safety of the electrical and water system within the building. And 13, preventive maintenance on the building. Again, we will recommend that we take no action here today because these concepts are going to be folded into a larger issue that we'll look at later on today. And I would entertain a motion.
So move. Second.
Then move the second. Polly, please call the roll on 12 and 13.
Yes.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Yes.
Aye. Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Tim Jeff?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye.
Aye.
18 passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll move to proposal number 114. This is to utilize Internet communications for the legislative process. This was obviously a generic proposal from someone out there. The committee recommends that we take no further action on this. After listening to testimony, we believe the committee, the committee acknowledges that legislative information is already readily available on the Internet, and it continues to grow all the time, including items related to documents, audio, and video coverage. And we obviously got people very concerned about making this better all the time, and so with that in mind, we would recommend that no further action be taken on that recommendation.
All right, you take that one separately.
Yes.
114, all right.
Yes.
We'll do this by voice vote. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Thank you. 134.
Okay, thank you. We now move to Proposal 134, review use and necessity of the House and the Senate lounges. I'm not exactly sure why this came down the pike, but nonetheless, we took it into consideration. We recommend that no further action be taken on this. We had an opportunity to visit with Ramona and Judy. Took some testimony about the current usage of the House and the Senate lounge. It works well. It is self-supporting. It is generally thought that the House and the Senate lounges improve camaraderie and a whole lot of discussion on issues apart from the public leaning in. And it's frankly a great experience that's enjoyed by almost everyone currently serving in the legislature. The only issue that we heard that surprised us a bit, and that is that one-third of the senators do not subscribe to food in the lounge. For what reason, it was unknown. So, with that said, I think the committee felt very comfortable with the current usage of the House and the Senate lounge, and so we would request no further action be taken on this.
Is there a
motion?
All right. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Thank you. 4 is 1.
008. Paperless floor sessions is the proposal before you here. I suppose the idea behind the proposal coming from the one of our members was that we do, in fact, cut down on paper. The legislature runs through a tremendous amount of paper. Every day we get bales of paper on our desks. And so it is a good idea, you know, that we look for ways to do this. Committee recommendation was that the legislature use technology to the best of its ability to expedite the legislative process, including the possibility of using consoles or laptops on the floor or in committee, the electronic bill book technology, the ongoing or on-demand printing, which could cut down on the mandatory, seems like the mandatory issuance of paper. Committee encourages the legislature to approve rules to govern the use of technology in committee meetings and on the floor. So we have already taken steps to move to wireless technology here, which will allow for the use of laptops here and there. Basically, we're just recommending to the legislature that they improve on existing technology and look at new technologies in order to cut down on the use of paper.
Is there discussion? Commissioner
Bunning, Chairman. I think, well, I, for one, and I believe there have been others that I've talked with who are on the commission and otherwise, who have been reluctant to move technologically forward in some areas, like, for example, putting laptops on the desks. And after consideration, especially in the discussion that we had in committee and testimony that we've heard from our IS people and others, and visiting the state of Washington and seeing that they've basically done it and the place hasn't fallen apart, it seems to me, that, and you've all heard this kind of a trite expression before, but it seems to me that it is true, and we should start embracing technology in this building as opposed to resisting because of some antiquated concept that we may have of what could happen. You will notice in the recommendation from the committee, the last sentence deals with the House and the Senate adopting rules that would deal with disciplining the use of the technology. For example, I think we would probably encourage members some way or another to not be doing their email and reading the newspaper and playing games and such things on their laptop on the floor or in committee while there is serious deliberation under consideration on issues. I mean, it goes without saying, but that can be dealt with by rules, and I don't believe that it's a good reason because we anticipate that that could happen occasionally, that we should in any way suppress our moving forward and embracing technology. I thought the discussion in the committee was good and wholeheartedly support the recommendation.
Commissioner Wilson has posited the saving of paper as a primary reason. I'd like to add to that currency of information so that it is much more clear who's working on what version of what piece of otherwise paper, and that there are substantive reasons for those both represent substantive support. Plus, I wish it were worded a bit more strongly, muscularly or something, because the importance of the legislature moving into the future, the technological future, faster than it appears to be happening now, is so I just want to use this moment to say, in many respects, not just this one motion. Thank you.
I'd just like to add to what Commissioner Wilhelms excuse me, was saying. When we went up to the state of Washington, one of the areas where we visited was the committee area, and they had a screen which was, you know, live, just like a PowerPoint, continually going to show the bill, and you could alleviate all the paper piles in committee rooms and people not being able to get a copy of testimony because it's right there. And if you want it later, you can print it or whatever, save it, read it, if you're having all that extra time on your hands. But it was very positive.
Any other discussion?
I also believe it'll help save time, and as we move toward the end of session, when literally a lot of what we spend our time in is literally waiting for things to print. And maybe that time could be spent actually reading the bills and reading the committee statements and reading the fiscal analysis and reading all of these materials instead of just waiting literally sometimes 4, 5, 6 hours just to print all those materials and get them on the desk. So I think it's great.
Commissioner Latimer.
I'd like to move the approval of the committee's recommendation.
Second.
Commissioner Herring, Commissioner Senator Gourley, did you eat? Would you have a comment?
I support the recommendations, but I don't think we ought to kid ourselves. That's going to reduce on the amount of paper. First of all, if it does reduce it in the capital, it increases the use of paper elsewhere, as people don't get copies of anything, so they download it and print it out themselves. And that, I guess, is a savings, except not overall, just to the state. As far as waiting for stuff to be printed, I in another context, I think we said that we want the process to be as deliberative as possible and as slow moving as we can possibly make it. That's why we don't want a unicameral legislature. So I would think that there's a downside to this, but I don't think we can actually do anything about any of this, so I think it makes sense to pass this recommendation.
Yeah, just a question, wondering if the committee discussed at all what resources, technological, other resources are needed by legislators for their district offices. It's one thing to have a nice laptop on your floor desk, and just wondering if that discussion took place at all.
Thank you. To my recollection, we did not discuss that. I might defer to staff or co-chair Wilhelms, but I think we did not discuss that.
Well, I don't know if it was a matter of discussion or not. I think that's why we talked about laptops. You can take the laptop to your district. It wasn't going to be isolated to your desk on the floor. However, the other side of that was that maybe a laptop was not the way to go, and there was supposed to be, I believe, some investigation by the chief clerk and the secretary at IS to see what kind of consoles might be being used elsewhere, because there are, Florida comes to mind as a place where they have a console on the floor desk, and that would be, if you had that, then the question of laptops would be a separate question, because the console on the desk would accomplish what we're talking about on the floor. But it's still a good idea for members to have laptops these days, because you can obviously do your job from anywhere.
I have to make a comment about this. Because of running a county government, even if it's one of the smallest in the state, I've got to tell you, if you think that it's going to be less expensive, it is not going to be less expensive. Because you will only be able to use your hardware for a length of time, and then the new software won't be able to be used on that hardware, so you'll have to buy new hardware. And we are all trapped in this. So I am sure I agree with Commissioner Herring that this is probably the way things are going, but I must tell you, it is very, very expensive.
Will I make one additional comment?
You bet.
In defense of our worthy committee chair, it did come up in discussion in the committee that we really had some meaty issues in that committee to deal with, and we came out with a strong number of recommendations, every single one of which costs money. And so it should not reflect on the committee chair or the committee members for that matter, but I think that when it comes to talking about hardware and bricks and mortar and so forth, we are talking about an investment of some capital dollars into this, and so that remains to be seen how much we're talking about with each of these projects, but the fact is that you can't get them done unless we spend some money, so we ought to warm up to opening up our pocketbooks a little bit and not be too critical of the leader of the committee.
No, and I don't disagree with that at all. Because you have to spend money to stay abreast of what's going on. It's just that don't do it thinking that it isn't going to cost.
I would like to thank the co-chairs for that. I was known by many nicknames in my time here, but Tax and Spin Wilson was not one of them. Ironic it's turned out the way it has.
I intend to support this proposal, but technology is a little bit two steps forward, one step back. There are many people in my own enterprise, higher education, who thought that a laptop at every student's desk would be a great improvement, and now many professors are banning laptops because they're seeing, if they're in the back of the room, too many games of poker being played instead of attention to the classroom discussion. So there are some actual distractions from the deliberative process that I would hope that rules would be careful to recognize, and I think you actually need to go into it recognizing that there are rules there, just as in days that Representative Wilhelms and others will remember there were rules against newspapers on the House floor.
Is there a motion?
I think I had one, but it may have died for lack of second. I don't know.
All right. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you. We will continue with proposal number 14, hearing rooms equipped for video and audio coverage. Your committee does have a recommendation about this. This comes forward due to the fact that a number of the hearing rooms are not equipped to do everything. In fact, there has to be a lot of strategic moving of specific hearings to certain rooms because of capabilities that are in perhaps that room only. And as a result, you can bump into backlogs and logistical problems sometimes. And so what we would do with item number 14 is recommend that the legislature, and this is simply a recommendation to the body, that they provide funding for audio and video upgrades in each hearing room and the chambers so that the coverage capability are consistent in all the locations. Provide funding for the recording and archiving budget option package so that recordings of the events can be easily indexed and committed to a media that is going to last longer. Currently, cassette tape is the way most of this is bagged, and it's not good for the shelf life, really. It will go away in time. And so digital technologies, at least, are probably better suited for the long-term storage. But we're simply asking them to look into that. And then to provide adequate maintenance and replacement budget of the legislature's audio and video systems to ensure that the equipment is kept up to date with current technology. So from the committee, a recommendation that we try to achieve consistency here in these locations and that we do a better job of archiving to a more permanent storage ability.
Is there a motion?
I would move, Madam Chair, adoption of the committee's recommendation.
Second. Been moved to second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Okay, thank you. We are going to do en bloc item 27 and item 40 from the either a member or the public came the recommendation that we review technology issues. And item number 40, review distribution of video coverage of legislative activities. So we put these two together. And your committee does have a recommendation here. We've combined these to recommend that the legislature contribute money needed for a 24/7 Oregon Channel pilot program that will be really coming to bear in the 2007 session. And really to establish this pilot, which is going to involve unedited C-SPAN type coverage, if I can say, which will let people see exactly what is going on in a number of locations in the Capitol. We think that ultimately this would let people see in an unedited way the committee hearings, floor sessions, news conferences, Supreme Court proceedings, state agency meetings, and things of that nature. So we're recommending that the legislature endorse the pilot project. The price tag looks to be about $150,000 on that. I think if this pilot project is successful and workable, it will be, I think, a great boon to citizens and voters in the state of Oregon wanting to see exactly what is happening inside the building.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Now I'd like to move to item 26, security issues. The last two items here are a bit more complicated, and so we want to take a moment to tell you about these.
Security issues, I think, have been at the forefront in a lot of minds ever since 9/11. And when we think of security in this building, we think of the incident a couple of years back where a man came in the building and, I guess fortunately for us, held a knife on himself rather than another. And but that did show, to our consternation, just how easy it is for someone to get through and get into the building. Obviously, a part of this discussion involved what you want your Capitol to look like, what you want accessibility of the people's building to be, what it should look like, and how it should be experienced by everyone. These are not easy issues, and this took us a while to hash through. And I'm not sure that we are entirely comfortable with where we went. Some of us, I think, on the committee, and if we had our way, security would be much more evident and much tighter. And others on the committee were concerned that the building remain fully accessible, but yet I think they felt that security should certainly be tighter than it is. So we came up with a recommendation. It is not perfect, like a lot of other products that we have generated here, but you know, ultimately this is a step, I think, in the right direction. So if I might just talk about some of the high points here. The committee recommendation, we're recommending that the Legislative Administration Committee be encouraged to establish who, what, and when background checks will happen for building employees, that the legislature take appropriate measures to increase security in the parking garage. That's an area of vulnerability that we were uncomfortable with. To increase uniformed officer presence, we think that that will have a positive impact. Increase member and staff training regarding security issues in the building. Address secure access to the building, including security equipment and personnel. And to encourage legislative administration to work with the legislative assembly to fund identified deficits, but that they balance the security of the public and employees with public access to the building and the legislative process. Again, this is really an imprecise science, but this is what we came up with. So that is before us. I expect to have some discussion on this.
Yes. Are there any questions or discussion?
A question for the committee chair. Commissioner Wilson, did you discuss about the desirability of state standards meshing with whatever federal standards there are of the Department of Homeland Security or others? I applaud where you're going. I think you have to. None of us wants to see barbed wire around our public capital. But we also know that the federal government is imposing all kinds of restrictions on access or security checks and so forth. Is it understood that this would be done in conjunction with whatever federal requirements there might be that might be implicated, or is this really our own course that we're pursuing?
Thank you, Commissioner Frohmeyer. It's really our own course, and I want to defer to any other member of the committee who may have a better recollection than I do, and I might defer specifically to Commissioner Ramirez about that.
Can you help us? We didn't have any specific discussions around the issue of would this conform with Homeland Security. I would defer to Capitol staff, but certainly discussion took place in reference to access, balancing that with it not being too restrictive, but yet being able to protect the employees as well as the public. As you well know, a block and a half from here, the Marin County Courthouse is still shut down. And we have one of the tightest courthouses in the state, but yet an individual had the fortitude to drive through our front doors because we didn't have the barriers in the front of the courthouse. So believe me, folks, we're susceptible to these kind of acts, and I think we're heading in the right direction with this recommendation of looking at our strengths and shortcomings around security here at the Capitol. But on that particular issue on the Homeland Security, I don't know if staff would be able to answer that question.
Herb?
Madam Chair, for the record, Herb Colom, Facility Services Manager, Legislative Administration. We have had
several other agencies come in and look at the Capitol and give us recommendations, one of which was Secret Service. So we are working with both federal and state agencies. Sheriff Ramirez's office has also done the same thing for us. So we're trying to go out and find the experts who can give us the right answers.
Isn't it true, Herb, though, we're tied directly to the levels of security in this building are tied directly to the federal alert levels?
We have a matrix set up exactly where, depending on what the national alert level is, we can take steps here in the building that would tighten down our internal security.
Linda Gordley.
Thank you. Is there a suggested timeline from the committee regarding these recommendations? I'm listening for a sense of urgency.
Thank you, Commissioner Gordley. We have not given a specific date to be completed by, but we have, I think, and I would hope, impressed upon staff that it is our desire that they turn to immediately on the project and go in haste.
One additional comment. That is my concern, that urgency be assigned to all of these tasks. And then just as a side note, I'm just paranoid enough to be bothered by the mailbox that has been added next to the parking structure. So someone tell me how that happened or...
Good, Mr. Combs-Jones.
We'll try to answer that one for you. That was put in at the request of the Postal Service. There is a rule that exists within the postal regulations that they are not allowed to service a building that they cannot access 24 hours if they have a pickup within that building. To paraphrase, and I'm not sure I've got that exactly right, but the idea was that we normally have our mail picked up between 5 and 5:30 in the evenings. We have always gone out of our way to make sure that if the mailman wasn't there, that we had somebody that could get them in. That did not satisfy the postmaster's requirements. So they put the box outside so that if they weren't here by 5:30, we could put the mail in that box for them to pick it up so they would not have to enter the building.
I think that location needs to be revisited along with an overall security plan, scan. I'm thinking of in my own neighborhood, we've been doing a lot of work around crime prevention and removing things that could be an invitation to someone.
I can try. Again, we're talking about the U.S. Postal Service who are not as flexible as sometimes we would like. But let me try.
Commissioner Herring.
Obviously, this recommendation is a commonsensical one. But how, on the other hand, do we guard against it being carried out too literally or too zealously? I think one of the most impressive things about Oregon and about the Capitol is its openness. People come here from other places, even from Washington, D.C. that is, and so on. And it sends the signal that this is the kind of state that it is. Now, I know we don't want barbed wire, but when we're starting to talk about screening areas and electronic screening and certain places where you can't go and signs that say don't go here and don't step on that place and you can't be here, and I think it is just it would send completely the wrong signal about the state and about this capital. Mr. Wilson talked about the one incident of somebody holding a knife to his own throat, I guess. You know, I mean, one incident in 150 years, I just can't see that as being the signal for anything drastic to be done. Surely it makes sense to have officers or to have personnel in the building who kind of keep an eye on things, and if somebody comes in with a firearm ready to shoot, then something ought to be done. But you can have a courthouse, as in Marion County, as the sheriff said, it's the most secure place in the world, and then something else happens that you didn't foresee. So I think, while I don't suggest that we just take chances, I think it makes sense to take prudent steps. I just don't want it to go so far that anybody gets the idea that this is not the Oregon that it used to be. That wouldn't be worth it. That wouldn't be worth it.
If I could respond, and I appreciate your concerns, not to jump into this and not look at all the fine detail, but the reality, that Marion County Courthouse is a block and a half from here, and through the stringent security measures that we've taken, I can't tell you that thousands of weapons that we have seized, and those same county residents visit the Capitol and come through the Capitol with weapons. And that's what we're trying to prevent is, and we're seizing those weapons, guns, knives, et cetera. And I'm not saying that, do we have to wait till another incident occurs here at the Capitol before taking the security measures? I understand your point. But the reality is we've got a changing landscape, a changing world. We don't want to take away what Oregon is known for. But at the same time, we have a responsibility to protect our staff here at the Capitol, and I've heard from staff that have been victims of crimes here at the Capitol that, we need to eliminate and minimize that as much as possible. Is it going to be 100% foolproof? We'll just have to keep working at it. But I think that's what the discussion and the recommendations were taking us, was to provide some type of plan to help minimize and mitigate that as much as possible.
Well, I appreciate the concern, obviously, and if people are nervous to be in the building, I don't know. Maybe you ought to get more courageous people. I don't know. Point is, if you have thousands of weapons that are confiscated now that didn't cause any problem, then the only problem you got is you confiscate them. I mean, if people walk through here with weapons and they're disarmed but they don't do anything, then what's the problem? I would think. But again, I think it makes sense to be prudent, but especially when we start talking about listening or asking federals for advice, then I really get worried, because I think they completely overreact on almost everything they do. And so I think it makes sense to say, look, we've got to make sure that we don't have some obvious risks here, but let's not start having metal detectors so that a citizen wanting to testify on some bill has to first lay all his coins in the tray and take off his shoes. I mean, that just would not work.
Commissioner Sheedy.
I just appreciate the last part of the recommendation to balance the security of the public and employees with public access. I think that's what we're talking about. And just want to be clear on where the decision-making would occur about how far we go. And would it be in the Legislative Administration Committee?
It is my understanding that would be correct.
And who makes up that committee? I forget.
Herb, would you respond to that, please?
I don't have the list, but it's members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, and it's a standing committee, and we meet periodically with them, and this would be something that the administrator would present to them as a proposal.
And then the funding of that would come back to the Legislative Assembly.
Correct.
Any more questions for Mr.
Powell? If I might just ask Herb one question. In testimony, was it, and in committee, was it your impression that the committee was concerned and wanted the Legislative Administration Committee to move with haste on this.
Absolutely. We are pursuing a couple of things as we speak. We are, first of all, concentrating on the garage. That has been identified in several studies as an area that needs additional protection. It's not a public area, so it's not going to be as obvious to the man on the street that we're doing something down there. But it will enhance the safety of the people that come and go through that area. We've also have some recommendations for looking at additional equipment that could be utilized around the Capitol, and we're making arrangements to see what is all available out there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I would thank the committee for bringing this forward. I think it's easy to think about the big events that could potentially happen, but as a almost 10-year employee of this building, I mean, there are things that happen, everything from petty theft to individuals getting into the garage that aren't about putting something in a mailbox or someone with a knife on the floor, and that just speaking to the issues of increased training and some of our day-to-day operations. I mean, when the knife did go on the floor, there was no instruction to me as the chief of staff to the Senate president about how to, as we were going into floor session, about what I was supposed to be doing in terms of keeping people off that floor. And those measures, I think, would be very helpful even before you get to the metal detectors and some of the big ticket items, if you will. Some of those just trainings and daily things I think are really important. I think that, you know, there's some employees who at certain times of the day, you know, aren't as excited to be here as others, but and I think our folks do a good job. But, you know, you can it's good for the committee to bring this forward.
Any more discussion? And entertain a motion.
So moved.
There's a second. Okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And let me bring the final item before you today. This is proposal number 33, facilities evaluation. Just a little background. What we're talking about is a major renovation to the House and Senate wings. This project was approved some years back, but the wheels came off when the economy went south. And so it is back before you from the committee. The Capitol Wings, as you can see in our committee discussion, opened in 1977. A tremendous amount has happened since that time with technology and with other issues as well. One of the things that I think just amazed us, and frankly, as I look back to my time in the legislature, it was true in the years 1999 through 2002 when I left, and that's the fact that the water is practically unusable in the House wing, and I presume it's the same in the Senate wing. Quite often you will see the ceiling tiles being soaked by leaks that are happening and the pipes that have corroded within the wings. The electrical systems are hopelessly behind at this point in time due to the fact that personal computers have come to the building in that time and they have overloaded the wiring system. The network cable trays throughout the wings are overloaded as well. Reports of bad air. Some of the things, the alterations that have occurred between floors to allow wiring to pass between floors have led to what could easily be called a chimney effect if a fire would break out, which would be very dangerous to have. Sprinkler system not up to code. Bottom line is the wings are in very, very bad shape and are really in need of renovation, which, again, I say was approved before, but the project was stopped when the wheels came off the economy around 2002. So legislative administration would like the approval to engage in a plan update, which will cost about, as I recall, $150,000 to update the plans that have been drawn up previously. That's what it will cost to retool. Codes have changed since the plans were drawn before, which will necessitate an upgrade of those plans. they can, from their existing budget, pull that money. Their hope, obviously, is to be reimbursed when the legislature is requested to sell COPs, certificates of participation, to finish this project. Again, ultimately, and I want to point out that you are not voting today to appropriate money for this. You are asked to give your approval on the plans to begin ramping up again for the renovation of these wings. The E-Board will ultimately give authorization for an acquisition of COPs. So, again, it goes to the legislature. They will have the final say, but it is our hope today that we will recommend the opening up of this again so that we can ramp up and ultimately head to a renovation of these wings.
Dave, would you like to come up again in case anybody has any questions? Are there any questions about this either to Commissioner Wilson or to Dave? Chair Wilson.
Dave, maybe you could just quickly take the committee through the time frame that we're talking about here. If we approve this and the legislature accepts it and approves it, what we're looking at as far as the timeline for getting the entire project completed.
Madam Chair. Co-Chair Wilhelms, again, for the record, Dave Henderson, Legislative Administrator. To be prepared to start construction immediately following the 2007 session, we need to start the updating of the plans in June of this year. That's the architect estimates that the time to update the plans, go through the permitting process, the bid process, we've got to get started in June of this year. We would use June through basically September, October to go through that updating of the process. We would go out to bid shortly after the first of the year and award the contract prior to the end of the 07 session. And then immediately upon sine die, we would move all of the legislators out of their offices, and we would move the offices of Legislative Council, Legislative Fiscal, and Legislative Revenue out. We would begin demolition, would then come in with the construction work, and would be back in the building ready for the 09 session.
Another explanation, further explanation, would be the authority for the COPs that we did have had expired, so we need to get reauthorization through the legislature of those COPs, and that would have to occur, as I remember the discussion, early in the 07 session.
Chair Wilhelms, that's correct. We do have to come back to the full legislature for new authority on the COPs, and that would have to happen in the 07 session. And early in the session, there is a COP sale scheduled, I believe, for March of 07, and we would want to participate in that sale to be able to start the work in hopefully July of 07.
Representative Krieger.
Dave, what would be the effect of a August 7th session ending?
Chair Pryor, Representative Krieger, that would make things difficult because we do have a very aggressive schedule to complete the project in an 18-month period. So it would certainly make matters more difficult for us. We would have to look at using other space in the building, perhaps, if we were not able to complete by the 1st of January of 2009. And certainly we've got hearing rooms such as this one in hearing room 50, 343, 347. So we would have some alternatives, but a late adjournment would make things difficult.
Yeah, interesting.
Dave, how would this work? And I say this as a huge supporter of doing something with the wings, as someone who would like little kids to visit the Capitol and drink the water. How would this work with the earlier proposal of an annual session from the commission? How would you, I know you can work magic, so what kind of magic would you work there?
Chair Pryor, Commissioner Seely, my first phone call would be to Commissioner Latimer, because as the Marion County courts have been located in the Capitol for the last several months, I believe that we might want to look at the Marion County Courthouse as an alternative location.
Oh, I don't think so. So there would be physically we would not be able to have session, or would the chambers be? I mean, is it just the wings, or is it the old part would be active and members just couldn't have their offices, but they could physically come to the chamber?
Very good question. The chambers would be totally usable, as would, as I said, the four other large hearing rooms in the old portion of the building. So while the work may be somewhat disruptive, it would not prohibit the legislature from meeting in the chambers and using these hearing rooms.
Commissioner Hill.
So what is the price tag? Chair Prior, Commissioner Hill, we really don't know right now. I can tell you that about 4 years ago, which is the last time we had what we felt was an accurate estimate, it was about $17 million. Now, the price of structural steel has gone up considerably, as has prices for everything else. So I can tell you that it was $17 million 4 years ago. I would hate to even hazard a guess as to what it might be today.
Thank you.
Yes, Co-Chair Pryor, I would like to mention before we go to a vote again that this sum does not address at all the seismic update of the main building and the things that really, quite frankly, someday have to be done to the main building. Our tour of the building has shown, especially in the governor's spaces, that pretty cramped and antiquated. I was frankly surprised. So some things have to be done there too someday.
Can I throw in one more comment? I was encouraged. The Department of Administrative Services happened to be watching on closed-circuit television the meeting when Carl's committee was discussing this, and as a result of the discussion, we have had a subsequent meeting, and I guess we're going to have more meetings with DAS to coordinate with the executive branch as they move forward with the construction of an additional office building on the mall, which... the effect of which filters back to the legislature and the need for additional space for legislative agencies in the Capitol building, because it will allow, once it's constructed, a migration from, for example, from the public service building to the new office building, and will free up space in the public service building for folks to move out of the Capitol building, like, for example, staff to the governor, secretary of state, and the state treasurer, which would free up additional space for our legislative agencies and so forth. That could have happened anyway, but the fact that we discussed that in the committee kind of stimulated some communication, and now the two branches are working together, and I think it's going to have very positive results. It's related to the WIGS project, but it's certainly not part of it. It's a totally separate effort, but you can look for something like that over the next few years to be occurring, and I think it's very, very positive for state government and the legislature, which is our concern here as a whole. I think it's going to be good.
Thank you, Dave, very much. Well, this is another piece of the system that we're talking about. You really can't separate the nuts and bolts and bricks and mortar from all of the structural discussion that we're having here. I think every courthouse in this state can tell you that the longer you put off trying to take care of it, the more it's going to cost you in the long run. So with that, I entertain a motion.
Make the motion, Mr. Chairman.
I'll defer to you, Mr. Brown.
I would move, Madam Co-Chair, that the Commission adopt recommendation 033 from the Facilities Committee.
Second.
Second.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion carried. Thank you very much. And thank you, Chair Wilson, and all of your committee for all of your work.
Thanks to the...
You're only 3 minutes late.
Thanks to the Commission for your kind attention today. I appreciate it.
Commissioner Frohmeyer.
Yeah, Madam Chair, for the record, this is the kind of recommendation that sometimes is very hard for legislators to carry themselves, because it's always possible for an opponent in an election to be a demagogue about legislators' space. But I'd like the record to show, and I think the vote does, that this is the public's space. It needs to be safe. It needs to be accessible. These are expenditures that need to be made for those purposes. So this is really would be, if the legislature approves it, in my view, a vote for the public And I would hope that the record would show that the commission is unanimous and that the votes of the legislators who sit on this commission were not necessary for the passage of the recommendation.
Right. In fact, one of them was.
We are going to break for lunch. I'd like to ask all of you, we did not have everyone here today. At 1 o'clock, the business community in Oregon is going to come in and have a first discussion with us, and I hope that most all of you can come back for that. We will be out of here at 2 o'clock or shortly thereafter.
You would like me to?
Please. One more thing.
Just quickly before we go to lunch.
Please, we're not excused yet.
To
gentlemen, not excused yet, please.
To update you on a little restructuring that has occurred within the commission. It became apparent that there were two committees that had similar issues, and it became confusing when they started to deliberate specifically one issue, which dealt with staffing, but there was overlap between the two committees, the Management Committee and the Human Resources Committee. And to make a long story short, after consultation between the co-chairs and the chairs of the respective committees, Mr. Latimer and Ms. Seeley, it was determined that a good way to go to solve this problem would be to merge the two committees into one kind of super committee. Not the two committees meeting separate or meeting jointly as separate committees, but to reorganize and make one committee with both of the seated chairs as the co-chairs of that committee. So we have done that. And I don't believe that it takes any action on the part of the commission to do that or to anoint it. I believe that the co-chairs have the authority to do that. Obviously, if there are concerns about that, we want to know about it, and we will deal with them. But I would—I think this is going to help us move forward with the issues that are before those two committees. And if there was an oversight or a problem in this regard, it was the way we structured it and referred the suggestions to committee in the beginning. It was not any fault of the two committees involved. But it seems, though, that it would we have pretty wide acceptance, I think, from the membership and the co-chairs of the two committees involved, and we ought to be able to move forward expeditiously with the four or five major recommendations that they have under consideration.
I want to thank both of the new co-chairs, too, for being willing to work this out. Thank you very much. All right, we are recessed. Thank you. On our agenda this afternoon is the leader. Duncan Wise is here to talk to us and bring us some information and ask us questions or whatever from the Oregon business community. Welcome, Duncan. It's nice to see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You want me to proceed? Oh, thank you. Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be before this commission this afternoon. My name is Duncan Wise. I am president of the Oregon Business Council. The council is an association of approximately 50 business executives from a wide variety of Oregon companies from throughout the state. And our mission is to mobilize business leaders to contribute to Oregon's economic prosperity and quality of life. We do that by addressing a relative handful of public policy and opportunities facing Oregon at any given time. And what we try to do is pick a topic and drive as far as we can into that. And as we do so, form a lot of partnerships along the way with community groups, the executive branch, legislators, wherever the policy arena takes us. We've worked on a wide range of issues over the years, education, transportation, public finance, healthcare, land use, natural resource policy, to name a few. And again, we've enjoyed a whole lot of partnerships with a lot of different groups. I'm here because the co-chair asked me. We had lunch just 2 weeks ago, I guess it was, and we got into a conversation and about with about five business leaders, and we just got talking about the legislature and its role in Oregon life, and she asked me to come and offer some remarks I do this on my own. This is not an Oregon Business Council position here. We haven't formed a position on your work. I would offer, as we talked at that meeting, the possibility, if you have some questions or ways you want to engage the business community, we have talked since then, and I'd be happy to do that. As you do your work to test out your ideas with folks in the business community. So with that in mind, I'm going to be very informal on this afternoon and make a few remarks and maybe open some conversation. What I'd like to do is give a little history of my history in working with the legislature over the years, present from my perspective using in particular a document which we use very heavily in our work, the Oregon Business Plan, and the latest version which I circulated. Ask the question, as we look ahead over the next 10, 20, 30 years or so, the time frame this group is really dealing with, what are the requirements for the Legislative Assembly in supporting Oregon life? And I think as we talk about that, it's a daunting challenge facing this commission and the legislature. I think the requirements are very, very high, and I'll explain in a minute. And then with those requirements in mind, I'll give you my perspective on some of the challenges facing the legislature based on recent history, and then some suggestions. If you buy into what I'm suggesting as the requirements for the legislature, some things that you might want to recommend in your report for advancing the legislature going forward. So that's my agenda. I open with a perspective. I am not one who gripes or grumbles particularly about the legislature. In fact, I go out on the Rotary Club circuit and actually talk about the great work the legislature does. And some people are sort of stunned when I do that. But over the last 4 years, we in the business community adopted what's known as the Oregon Business Plan. It's a statewide initiative to represent the entire business community on what we need to be doing to support economic prosperity in our state. It's a broad agenda, has lots of initiatives associated with it. We draw a lot of different business leadership into the business plan. It's our effort to get organized, if you will, in the business community. And we've adopted a series of initiatives in that period, everything ranging from transportation to education to PERS reform to research in higher education, land use. It covers a wide variety of topics in the business plan. And in each area, I identified business leaders to work with partners in the community and the executive branch and the legislature to get work done, to accomplish things. And I will tell you, our partnerships with the legislature have been very, very positive in that period. And, in fact, we have a little initiative tracker scorecard. And in the last two legislative sessions, the legislature has done nearly all the recommendations that we suggested. And our members coming down here have felt very good about the relationships with the legislators, had good contact in both parties, both sides of the chamber. We've had regular meetings with the leadership in both sides, again, and worked across party lines and feel very good about it. So I'm not here to complain about recent legislative performance. We've had some really good successes, and I don't think, frankly, the legislature gets enough credit for the good work when they do it. So, because I really think they've done some remarkable work, despite all the contentiousness we see, and if you look at the public, the press, and other things. There's been a lot of good work on the range. If you want to look at the business plan website, you can see all the work that's happened in the legislature. But it includes things like funding and enhancing the ONAMI, the Nanotechnology Initiative, dealing with some of the critical land use issues. Some key initiatives in education, transportation, a whole series of packages in transportation. So there's a lot of good work, is my point, and so we're pleased with that. And I also tell you that from our perspective, there are a lot of very hardworking, talented legislators. We have no complaint in that regard. So I come with a lot of positive perspective. As I look to the future, however, I see an enormous challenge. And it's not just for the legislature, it is for Oregon. And this is where the Oregon Business Plan and our work comes in. The Oregon Business Plan offers a vision for the future of the economy, what it's going to take for Oregon economically to be successful over the next 20 or 30 years or so. And when you talk with business leaders, especially those who are working in what we call the traded sector, those who have their products compete in global competition outside the borders of Oregon, across the world, we are in the most enormous competitive challenge imaginable. It's fierce. It's going to be incredibly difficult to be successful in the environment we're going into. And as we have talked with traded sector business leaders, and that includes everyone from agriculture to forest products to high tech to software to metals, manufacturing, the whole range, the message is very loud and very clear. Oregon cannot compete in a traditional commodity basis. If we're just producing widgets in a very ordinary way, we're producing any product in an ordinary way, there's somewhere else in the world that can do it cheaper in the world we have faced today. So the only way we're going to be successful is if we outsmart our competition, if we add more brain power, come up with new designs, be at the leading edge of the product design, be the leading edge of producing new production technology, coming up with a smart marketing way to market our products. Unless we're at the leading edge, we're not going to be competitive. And that's the vision that they all have. And again, it really doesn't matter which traded sector cluster we're in. That's where we are. And then
brains, not brawn.
Brains, not brawn. Good summary. And the great news, and this is fantastic news, and we don't talk about this enough in Oregon, is we are succeeding at the leading edge in cluster after cluster. Whether we're talking specialty agriculture, whether we're talking about innovative, sustainable forestry with the latest technology, whether we're talking about inventing the next wave of semiconductor chips, or in software, or in incredibly advanced metals manufacturing, we are leading edge in research, design. Again, in sector after sector, we're succeeding, but it is an incredibly intense fight. But the vision is right. We can do this. We can win because we're doing it right now. Now, when you talk to business leaders then about how important is the community to their long-term success, they have a lot of prescriptions about what it's going to take. And we've summarized the prescription in what we call the four P's for prosperity. And they are very important. The community makes an enormous difference to the success of traded sector firms. And they make it, and we call it the four P's, people, place, productivity, and pioneering innovation. People having to do with having excellent education resources that create the talent that feed a knowledge economy. Place being a great place to live that attracts talent and keeps us attracting the very best from around the nation and the world. Productivity, dealing with all the classic issues of infrastructure, telecommunications, regulatory systems, all the basics you might think of when you talk about productivity, getting really good at delivering the basics. And finally, innovation, pioneering innovation, ability to take ideas and move them really quickly, everything from research and development in universities, technology transfer, patents, a whole variety of different pieces. And the message that we got again and again is that we need to focus on all four. We have to be really good, and we need to stay concentrated. These aren't in conflict. We've got to recognize all of these are important to build the kind of economy we want in the future. Now, here comes the challenge as we think about the legislature and all of our work. When we look at all the major systems associated with community, and I'm talking about education, transportation, natural resources, health care, think of all the major public systems and think about them needing to be world-class in the 21st century, to be designed effectively, to be competitive with anywhere in the world. I ask you to imagine one of the systems that are major associated with the public sector that you think is world-class, first-rate, that doesn't need to be completely redesigned. I don't think there's one. We had a retreat a couple weeks ago. We went through an environmental scan. Most of the major systems associated with state government are 50 years old at the youngest. Most of them are completely, they're just from a different era. And the work ahead of us, quite frankly, as a state, as a legislature, is over the next 20 years to redesign every major public sector system. And so that is the demand. And to be successful competitively, that's what we must do. I would argue that under that very high bar, it's a bar that most legislators in the country I don't think are up to, we probably do not, that we come up short. I don't think we have the capacity right now to do that work. And it is that work that I think you ought to be talking about in your report, about the work that we need to do over the next 20, 30 years to reexamine everything in public service, the core delivery systems. Let me give you just a couple one example near and dear to my heart, and I know I see Dave here, it's near to his heart, and Gretchen, in the education system. I mean, I could spend 15 minutes and I think convince you, if you had 15, I can if you want, that the current delivery of education is obsolete. I mean, let me count the ways. You have a system where you have K-12, community college, and higher ed institutionally balkanized from each other with different budget systems, different systems of assessment, different curriculum systems. Gretchen is doing heroic work to try to unify those systems, but currently they are not. The budgets, each one is budgeted separately with a completely different distribution rules. Each has a completely different theory of governance. We have had 15 years ago a major shift of public policy around education to shift a lot of responsibilities to the state level. And again, looking friends here, James did an amazing job in that early years to try to think through the distribution formulas in K-12. But we frankly have not made the full adjustment of what it means to have the state responsible for the funding levels of K-12 community college. We have not adjusted to the fact that higher ed now receives the vast majority of its money outside state government. We do not have a theory of governance at the state level that makes sense for education in Oregon. Now, I could dwell on that at length. And I think we could all reach that agreement. Now, think about what is going to be required to change that system over the next period. It's going to take an enormous consensus that there's a problem. There's going to take an enormous amount of intellectual firepower to think through what the current system looks like and what the options are. And it's going to take a legislature that's prepared to think very, very deeply about what the governing model for education ought to look like, how it's going to change its budget systems. It's an enormous policy and governance change. And again, we need to think about the governance structure, the capacity, the institutional capacity of the legislature to take on a challenge of that magnitude. It will ultimately, I believe, mean a complete reconfiguration of committee structures, as well as a whole series of policy changes. So that is one example, but I think if you ask me to look at natural resource policy, I think I could make a similar argument. If you ask me to look at transportation, I could make a similar argument. I think it's a consistent pattern across the various systems. The other challenge facing the legislature, as you think about all these, is the ability to look long-term. Because as we do longer-term forecasts, as we've done recently in our own work, we've got some train wrecks coming down the road. As you think about health care costs, and where they're going and the imposition on state budgets, that's going to, if you just take the demographics of health care, you take the demographics of prisons and the demographics of education, and you go out very far, you can see train wrecks in the making. The current processes of the legislature don't necessarily spotlight those very easily. And so while we're doing this work on reinvention, we also need to work on getting out in front and looking ahead and making priorities on what systems to look at first. And again, that's a capacity we need in the legislature. So with that in mind, if you buy that there's some hard work to do, I'm now going to go back to civics, what I learned about how legislators are supposed to deal with these kind of issues. And as I learned it, the basic structure of the legislature goes like this. When a bill or idea is taken up, it first goes to the leadership, and then it is assigned to a committee. And the committees then take responsibility for going digging deeply into that policy area and learning a great deal in typically across political boundaries, so that when a result was come up with, it took it back to the floor for a full vote with the expertise of the committee behind that, so that you really had a very well polished product. In some cases, in the Oregon legislature, historically, you had joint committees. What Ways and Means, of course, being notable. I recall the days of the Trade and Economic Development Committee, a joint committee, where they spent an enormous amount of time, Jim Hill was on it, and you remember it well, learning about economic development policy. Not just one session, but I don't know, how many sessions were you on it, Jim? It was several. And really, by the time you were done, became an expert in that area, and I think had a staff that really was frankly more knowledgeable about economic development than the executive branch or really anyone in the state. I think that's fair to say. It was an enormous capacity the state had in the legislature to deliberate, to think, to come out with, I think we'd consider, effective bipartisan policy. And when the decisions were made, they tended to be unified and ready to go to the full floor. That's the kind of work that we need in Oregon. What I have watched, and I do not pretend to be an expert on legislative process. I am not a day-to-day lobbyist at all, so I don't understand the workings. But what I have seen over the last decade or so is a shifting of power and authority away from committees to an amorphous area, which I'm not sure I understand, but I think it's called the caucus. But what I think I understand, and again, you'll have smarter people and more knowledgeable people than I will need to help you on this. But what I've sensed is a shift of policymaking where the decisions on what to move when are made more in caucuses or someplace outside the committees than in the committees themselves. And I think the effect as an outsider who likes to participate is, you're never really clear when you're before a committee whether this is in fact the group that's going to actually be making the decisions on public policy. And you don't know, and you aren't sure that if you're educating those members, those are the members you really need to educate. And I would argue, I would make the case that as a one group that tries to participate, it makes it a lot harder if you don't really know where the game is being played. And frankly, if there isn't a group that is given the responsibility for really learning and becoming expert in the area, these problems are way too complicated to just assume that everybody somehow can get this and move. So I would argue recommendation one, in some fashion, let's regroup around the idea of having committees where the members become very educated in their areas and that they have the professional staff to really dig deeply into the public policy arena. So that's my, again, probably insufficient history of understanding of where the legislature, but I feel today, we again, just having participated over a number of years, that there has been a shift, and we need to think about that shift, and it's something you ought to address in your recommendations. So to summarize and a bit of recommendations here, as we look ahead from the business community and what we need is we need a legislature that, first of all, can look ahead and anticipate problems. We need the ability to do that. We need a legislature that can decide as a body where it's going to put its priority attention at any given time. You can't take on everything at one time. You've got to figure out where you're going to put your intense energy in any given period. We need a way to shape what the agenda is going to be and recognize that we have a lot of work to do over multi-years. We need a legislature that once it picks a topic, whether it's education or land use or whatever it is, can go deeply and intensely into that problem and really get a bipartisan understanding of it and come up with unified solutions. And in order to do that, to make major public policy changes out of that. We also need a legislature on an ongoing basis that can track performance of the public sector systems and hold those systems accountable for performance across these various enterprises. And again, with performance measurements and budgets tied to performance. Those are the characteristics.
Not just themselves, but, for example, public education.
Public education. I would, and again, this is all in statute now. Through work over the years. I mean, it is the statute, but we need the capacity to do this, in the case of education, to define what the educational outcomes are that we want for the state, to understand how the money that the legislature appropriates is tied to educational outcomes, and to track whether those outcomes are, in fact, being achieved, and have some ways to correct. And that's, again, across all of the systems. So, if we had that kind of a legislature, Oregon would be competitively at an astonishing advantage, because frankly nobody has that capacity. And so, but I think it would be of an enormous advantage. So with that in mind, again, there are a lot of other requirements for the legislature, but if you buy into those, what do we need? Again, a little bit more detailed recommendations. Number one, again, this early scanning capability. You won't be surprised to hear me, and I hope Dave is with me on this. I think the Progress Board is one good partner for this. We have an organization that is specifically assigned to scanning. I don't think we use it enough. I think the legislature should recommend and ask on a regular basis to have an environmental scan to identify what the big issues are, what the key trends are, and make sure that the legislature has a chance to discuss that scan and decide what it thinks is important as an entity. The second recommendation is I do think we need a long-term performance budget. You will see in our work one of the key public finance recommendations in the business plan is what we call a long-term performance-based budget. And by that is a budget that extends the conversation beyond 2 years into at least 10 years to understand what the underlying trends in the budget are. And then with those trends in mind, identifying whether it's a sustainable path, and if it isn't a sustainable path, a way to reinvent that system to get it on a sustainable path, and to create performance measures for those major institutions. So a performance-based budget. Again, a lot of great work has been done on this in the Ways and Means. I think we just need to build the capacity to do it. The third, I do recommend we think about some version of strengthening the community capacity. So outsiders know where the game is being played when you take up a major issue. That there's a place to go. And I would argue in the areas where you're going to put specific high-level focus to try to make it a joint committee, because that allows, again, everyone to hear all the information at once, to hear each other, so that when a resolution is made, it can go out to both floors together, and there's a way of bringing a consensus together. I think the Joint Committee is a good model in the select areas where the committee really, where the legislature really wants to put high priority attention. I think we have to think hard about professional staff. The staff in the legislature is terrific, and they're great folks. I think we need to think about making sure that they have the proper education training to know how to do really high quality policy analysis. It's something I feel strongly about, that part-time legislators need the help of folks who are professionals in bringing, knowing how to frame decisions. And I think professional development would be a really wise investment in terms of what the legislature needs. And then finally, and this is probably the most amorphous or difficult to define, but I think it's probably the most important, and that is the culture. We need to build a culture of cooperation in the legislature. I know there's always going to be partisanship, whether I think the open primary is a wonderful way to deal with some of the partisanship, but there's no magic here. But we need to have a legislature when the election's over where they see the competition not being each other and their parties, but other places. You know, we're in a competitive struggle. We need our legislature to understand the game isn't about within Oregon, about Republicans or Democrats. It's about Oregon and it's other states and increasingly other nations. And we want a legislature that is competitive and gets the recognition it deserves as being one of the great places in the globe in terms of dealing with public policy problems in a way that delivers great results in terms of the public services. So, again, I don't pretend to be an expert in these matters whatsoever. I do think it's a daunting challenge you face, though, as I look ahead. We have a great opportunity in the state, but it will depend heavily on the capacity of this institution to really solve very, very complicated problems. And I know they're up to it. It's just getting the right processes in place to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Duncan.
I have two general points. One of them is legislative structure, and the other one is legislative focus. On the legislative structure, Duncan, I would take it that your recommendations have certain implications for committee membership, and therefore certain implications for the appointing powers of the respective leaders of each house and or their caucuses. Because one of the things that it seems to me you're asking for is greater continuity of committee attention and control. That means greater continuity of committee membership, which means not only that there ought to be some relationship between interim committee membership and membership in the regular session, but it also directly implicates, I think, the appointing powers of the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate. And it would seem to me you're asking to constrain those powers within the longer-term desire for committee continuity and expertise, as you've described it. So that's point number one, which is your recommendations aren't benign, it seems to me. They carry in their wake certain implications for the partisan structure of the legislature, which, for its own reasons, has had different outcomes in the immediate past. And the second, with respect to legislative process, what's striking to me is how relatively little some of the longer-term foci that should flow into the process really do. For example, and I'm casting stones at neither or maybe at both, but I've rarely seen a Secretary of State's audit used in the appropriations process as a guide to agency behavior, a correction of agency action. I rarely see them. We spend a lot of money on those audits. Some of them we agree with, some of them we don't. But they seem to drop off the edge of the earth when the official process for dealing with agency structure and so forth is in there. I rarely see benchmarks used, although the Progress Board has been working on a bipartisan basis, as you know, since your tenure, for 15 years. I rarely see performance measures used, and they can be manipulated, as you know, from session to session, so there's not a lot of continuity there. And I never see something like the Oregon Business Plan used as a set of do's or don'ts or relative goods or not goods in terms of, you know, where does this legislative package stand up in terms of what Oregon's public and private business leaders, U.S. senators, the governor think. So there are implications in what you say for both of those processes, and we could do them tomorrow, but somehow they don't seem to be happening. So I wonder, Madam Chair, if I could ask the witness to respond to whether or not that my gloss on these makes any sense to you.
Madam Chair, Dave. Yes, I mean, I want to be clear where my perspective is. I am not, I think all the points you raised makes sense to me. I am not here to tell you how to restructure the legislature specifically. What I am here to say, I think, is that there are some enormous requirements for the legislature, which I would encourage you to lay out in your report, to say, and then put weigh your recommendations against those requirements. I will say, a frustration in the current process, often of having interim staff who may or may not be given back. And so, again, as an outsider who wants to work and know who to educate, to not know who the committee members are likely to be, it becomes a guessing game. And, frankly, it makes it much harder when we bring our limited resources to the table to know who to talk to, because there are 90 members, and you know, we often really have no idea who will matter in the session. So if there was some way to develop more, longer-term continuity of membership to committees that we knew we could work with and become acquainted with, that would be of huge assistance. Again, I know there's puts and takes in terms of your recommendations, but it is not a system now that is stable in terms of thinking hard about large public policy questions. Let's put it that way. The one thing I would say, though, again, I want to continue to stress, despite all my these concerns, and I think there's a model here to talk about in terms of our involvement with the business plan. We have had regular meetings. Gary's not here, but we've had regular meetings with the speaker. We do go through the list of initiatives in the business plan with both the president and the speaker, and they do guide us so that we get our business members connected with the right committee chairs or the right folks to actually make a difference, and we really appreciate that. So, again, it's not like nothing is happening, and again, even there's in each of these areas. But I just think it could be a lot better, that's all, if the right process.
I just wanted to clarify and make you feel better, Dave. at least when I was dropped into the budget process in April, all the agency budgets that I was able to review had performance measures included in the process. And the agencies, I think, actually liked them because it helped them plan better for their activities. So at least from my purview, it was happening at that level. So.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Commissioner
Wharton. I really appreciate your comments. Part of what is occurring to me while you were talking was the discussion early meetings about what's the 21st legislature. Was it you that brought that up?
It was our committee.
What does the legislature in the 21st century look like? And I like a lot of what he said to describe what some of those criteria might be as we try to communicate what we've done and why to the public. The other thing that occurs to me, having worked in large organizations, is that having a vision of what's possible and what's needed is critical to establishing the framework for what flows out of that. And I think that we haven't done that very well. Because the strategies and objectives and processes and structures that you were talking about, if they're not coherent with the vision, then it kind of falls apart and it doesn't end up being very effective. So the other thing that, part of what I'm getting out of what you've said that would be valuable for our committee is how do we communicate what the vision is, what the possibility is, what the requirement is, and how do we make that more available to the public? Mm-hmm. Economic prosperity is actually what pays for government. Government eats at the trough, it doesn't create wealth. And how do we communicate that in a way so that what we've done here is coherent with this long-term view?
Mr. Carmel.
Duncan, we had two recommendations before us this morning. One was to endorse an open primary, not necessarily ballot initiative 86, the other of which was to encourage the legislature to consider making itself nonpartisan in either or both of the houses. First of all, two-part question. Do those two recommendations meet the smell test for you as you look from outside? And secondly, are there some ways that you can suggest that you personally and or the business sector might partner with us to do what I think will require a major sales job, that is to say, we cannot instruct the legislature what to do, but we'd like to have the best possible chance at the bully pulpit.
Madam Chair, open primary, I personally am, I mean, I'm very supportive. I spent a lot of time on it, and the business community generally is, I've never seen more unity, although OBC officially hasn't taken a position, AOI has, Oregon Business Association has, and most of my members I know are supporting it and contributing to it, and I think it will be on the ballot this fall. And I think the argument for it is really basic. It's a fairness issue, first of all, that in many parts of the state, if you're an independent voter or if you happen to be in a district where you are in the minority, you have really no voice in who your legislator is going to be. And that just isn't fair. In many ways, and the effect of it is to capture, it potentially creates more polarization in the process. And from, again, what I was describing earlier, while it's very important to hear and air differences of opinion, it's also equally important to focus on what we have in common and make sure that we are focusing on our areas of agreement and making good public policy to support those areas. And I think that with the divisiveness that emerges in extreme, you know, with the greater partisanship, really can be a hindrance in that. So I don't know, how did you all decide on that? I wasn't here this morning, but I hope you
said to endorse an open primary and to recommend.
I think it's good. That's great. Well, I think it's a good opportunity on the nonpartisan legislature. I mean, I think it's well worth exploring as well. I mean, again, I haven't thought as much about it, and certainly not as live at the moment. I know it was in the session last time. But again, without being prescriptive, again, I think what we need is a legislative body that, while it has spirited debates, is focusing on finding the ground to move forward. I look at Senator Gordley on the student bill of rights, trying to bring a coalition together to solve a public policy problem. And I think that, you know, kind of spirit is where we need. And again, there's some great examples of that happening in this body, and there always has been. But the more of that kind of, you know, finding consensus, realizing once you're in the legislative body, the job is to do this people's work and move Oregon forward. I think both support that direction.
Follow up, Duncan, which is, an optimist, and I am sometimes an optimist, would say that if the organizing principle of the legislature were not party, if the organizing principle were talent or knowledge or ability, it might therefore result in the kind of commitment to committees and long-term education mm-hmm. that you have described.
No, and I think that's, in my, again, for those, I hate to, because I look around this room, so many of you have been around this more longer than I have, but my memory, and you know, Dave in particular, you were there, but my memory is of committee structures where if, you know, it was basically if you got a majority of the committee, didn't matter what party, you moved to the floor,
right.
And that was the deal. And I think that's changed now. If you don't have a majority of the majority, you don't move. And that's a very different environment. Because in that, the world I remember was, if you could work with the committee, make a rational case for whatever the public policy was, it didn't matter what the party lines weren't the important ingredients. That created that space for deliberation, consensus building, and again, when I stressed, ability to go deeply into a problem, because you could spend time with the committee so they would learn. And that's not a minor matter. The ability to learn.
The second part of my question was, do you think that you and or the business council can partner with us with the ideas, and first of all, determine what of our major hoped-for interventions should be supported and then support them?
Right. Well, Lauren, that's what we were talking about at lunch. What I'd like to do, and again, I can't thank you enough for coming to us and asking, but what I would like to do, and we've had further conversations, as you come up with recommendations, I'd like to pass them around to my colleagues and peers and just see what we can do on that. I can't commit at this point, but I know it's now on our agenda to try to take a look at the recommendations through the business plan and OBC and see if we can come back, and we'll definitely take a look. We are engaged, let me put it that way.
Commissioner Duncan.
Duncan, I'd like to ask you about the role
about the role of the executive, as you look at the kind of recommendations you just made and following up on Commissioner Frohnmayer's questions, would suggest that the role of the executive as we come through a budget process and working with benchmarks and progress objectives would need to be strengthened in order to keep the legislature focused. Do you have comments about that?
I haven't thought as much about anything about that. The role of the obviously the executive branch, from my point of view, it's in some ways easier to work when the executive branch is a governor and there's a formal structure from an outsider. It's actually much easier to work with the executive branch than it is the legislative branch, just because of the chain of accountability is a bit clearer in that case. But no, I mean, there is a definite relationship between the quality and strength of the legislature and the ability of the executive branch to perform well. If there's clarity of objective out of the legislature, if that's what you're asking and comment, then it's a lot easier for the executive branch to respond to the legislative intention. And ideally, a stronger legislature creates a stronger and more effective executive, and I think the other thing, of course, is true as well. But I'm not sure I'm fully grappling with your question.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. It's good to see you.
See you
this afternoon, and thank you very much for your thoughtful comments. Comments which are excellent, by the way, and leads me to want to explore with you, you know, with an eye toward next session and looking at the kind and quality of orientation training that we need to provide for new and returning members. I'm thinking about the quality of the information you're sharing. I'm looking at this document, which I've seen before, but this is something that should be seen and discussed with every new and returning member of the legislature. And so we need to create a venue that allows that to happen. And look at how we structure an orientation and training that allows this kind of information to be shared and discussed thoroughly, thoughtfully, and with the other voices that make up the business community that you cited, AOI, et cetera. So what I'm saying roughly here is that I think one of our challenges is to look at what kind of recommendation do we want to make to the legislature around that training and orientation and what that should look like in terms of content and participants and as a way of getting everyone on the same page and way of thinking, hopefully, before we launch into who's going to introduce what bill and for what reason.
And Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I would love to talk more. I mean, I don't have a prescription here, but I would love to anything we can do to help on that. I think, and it's an informal system, but I do think that early work before the session can make a huge difference if issues are framed with enough clarity. I don't have a clear roadmap, but again, the features I would hope is this broad scan, finding a way to make sure that all the members receive the same material, have a chance to reflect on it, and then, again, from an outsider's point of view, at least having some sense of where the priority direction is in any given session. Speaking for business, if we know the legislature is going to take up and go intensively on pick your topic, and we know in advance, then we can mobilize ourselves to provide a lot of support and research and whatever you might need. But if we know that there are, that from the outsider, it's often, you just got all these little swirling committees and factions and so on. You have no idea where the energy is, and you can't chase all that. And so if at the beginning of the session there's some sense of this is where we're going.
You mentioned, for example, the Oregon Progress Board.
Mm-hmm.
And most legislators, I think I can say this with accuracy, most legislators, current legislators, don't know the history of the Progress Board, why it's important to our public policy making work, how it should inform the budget making. They don't know. They don't have that that knowledge. So again, we need a venue and a way that and an opportunity that allows us to make that information available.
Well, again, I'd offer if it's an area you all want to explore, I'd love to explore that with you. I mean, I think designing something, again, I don't have a prescription, obviously, and you've got ideas. I think there are a lot of folks, not just the business community, who would love to think through with this committee and then legislators how to structure it. I mean, that won't solve all the issues, more the rules and so on that Dave was raising, but I think it would be a big help. I mean, again, and some of these are very informal processes, that how the session gets launched, what happens before the session, but they can make a real difference. I agree with you.
I know that we're going to lose a lot of you in a few minutes, so I want to have the last word. Commissioner Lindy.
Well, I wasn't going to give a speech. I was going to ask a question. You began your comments very positively with optimism about the legislative institution and good people who are trying to do good things in it and so on. And I listened attentively to what else you had to say. And I never heard any mention of the major long-term policy-making institution in this state, which is the initiative and referendum. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you'd given any thought to that at all. I mean, if you're talking about, go back to your first item, take education, and the structure of educational institutions and where the money comes from and so on. Mm-hmm. It's all been driven by initiated constitutional amendments. Is that something that you get, that your organization gives any attention to and thought to, and if there were any, even if you people aren't constitutional experts, but there is some way to escape some of that? What would you do?
Yes.
Would you be interested in talking to the committee about it?
Yeah. It is something I can tell you there's a great deal of frustration about, we have, over the years, the business community has been involved in some of the reform efforts. I think one I can think of in particular, which failed, but the ballot measure, basically change the rules for signature collection.
I wasn't thinking about those.
But as far as the constitutional, I think if that were an area of focus, we'd be. I'm quite sure there'd be a lot of folks who'd be very interested.
Well, it's on the agenda of one of our committees.
Mm-hmm. I haven't focused on that to tell you the truth. So I'd have to reflect more on it. Although I would say, we have watched initiatives rise and fall over time, and in part, I think the number of initiatives in part have to do with the ability, the sense of the public that the legislative body is dealing with issues. So I think insofar as there was more confidence that big issues were being tackled through legislative process, that might affect the initiative process to some extent. But it's not the only reason initiatives happen. I fully appreciate that.
Well, you were particularly interested in budget issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, and they do, and the initiative definitely drives budgets in a very, very big way, as well as just institutional arrangements. Again, your example in education, the Measure 5 wasn't just a budget issue. It was a fundamental governance change that we still have not fully dealt with. So you're absolutely right. Lots of things get presented to the public and addressed through that process. But again, in the end, I think a vibrant, effective legislature is one way to deal with the initiative system.
Duncan, thank you very much
for
coming today. Appreciate it, and hope that we see you again
and
hear from all of your folks.
Thanks so much. Let me know how we can
help. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen of the commission. Barbara?
Given the small number of commissioners who remain, could we ask that a transcript of Duncan's remarks be put on our, be distributed in writing?
That's a good idea.
And Barbara, you can
add a grammar check.
I wish to come in earlier, but just for the 2 minutes that we have, could the chair or committee chairs enlighten me on where these kinds of conversations are supposed to be occurring about the capacity and staffing and ability of the legislature to be structured to look long term? Whose committee is that?
Marjorie. I would say that some of those conversations are happening in the process committee, Ginny's process committee. I think with regard to staffing. That's coming up in the new Management and Human Resources mm-hmm. Committee. But really, a lot of this is happening in process. And again, all commission members receive all of our agendas. Mm-hmm. Anyone's invited. Mm-hmm. We're happy to have the more the merrier.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Duncan mentioned one thing that several of us were talking about before we came back in at lunch, and that is he was talking about working with the group on the final report and helping disseminate that. I think we need to think about how we may want to communicate this to the Oregon public and what we may want to do to get it spread far and wide. We have some members of the press here who could be helpful, but I think we need to think beyond that.
I agree. That is one task for that Gary and Marjorie and I are talking about. So we have been since day one, because that really is going to tell the tale on what happens here. So again, members of the commission, thank you very much, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the next meeting. We're adjourned. Thank you.